As vicar, you may daily find
the radio gigs are such a bind.
The new series of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. Monday night, 6:30 comedy. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4. On FM, on digital and BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 2nd of June. Good morning, this is Today with Anna Foster and Justin Wen.
Good morning. The headlines today. 9 people have been killed across Ukraine in a wave of Russian attacks. Reports from Kyiv say people are trapped in 2 damaged apartment buildings. And President Trump says Israel and Hezbollah have agreed that all shooting will stop after he spoke to both sides. But overnight attacks in Lebanon have continued.
And also in today's programme, fewer and fewer people think university is worth the trouble. We'll be asking 3 young people what they make of it. What if we could get rid of those little annoyances in life? Website pop-ups, confusing train announcements, a glut of WhatsApp messages from one's cabinet colleagues. We will be speaking to people on a mission to free us from such things. And ahead of the release of the latest Toy Story film, we hear from Buzz, Jesse and Woody, also known as Tim Allen, John Cusack and Tom Hanks.
I haven't really read the full through script after Toy Story 2. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? Give notes on what I think? No, it's not going to happen. You've got a friend
in me. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
Russia has carried out a wave of attacks across Ukraine using drones and ballistic missiles. Officials in the capital, Kyiv, say 4 people have been killed there and more than 50 injured, including several children. They say part of a hospital which was hit collapsed. Local authorities in the eastern city of Dnipro say that 5 people have died in attacks there. Moscow last week warned that it would launch systematic strikes on Ukraine. From Kyiv, Vitaly Shevchenko sent this report.
The attacks began in the early hours of the morning, with Russia sending a flurry of missiles and drones across Ukraine. In central Kyiv, we felt a building shake as a quick succession of missiles struck a neighborhood nearby. Ukraine's air defense systems rang out in the dark. Kyiv's mayor says that scores of people have been injured and several killed. As the sun rises, the full extent of the damage is being revealed. In the capital, at least 2 residential buildings and a hospital were damaged. Russia had warned last week it would hit targets in Kyiv and urged foreigners to leave the city.
Clashes have continued in southern Lebanon, despite a claim by President Trump that Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to stop fighting. Lebanon said last night that Hezbollah had accepted a US plan for a truce. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed the agreement, but warned strikes on Beirut would go ahead if firing by Hezbollah went on. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Donald Trump claimed that he'd persuaded both Israel and Hezbollah to de-escalate their conflict. In a post on his Truth Social platform, the US president said after a very productive call with Benjamin Netanyahu, no troops would be going to Beirut, and that Hezbollah, after what he said was a conversation with representatives of the group's leadership, had agreed that all shooting would stop. Mr. Trump expressed the hope that it would mark the end of fighting for eternity. Lebanon said it had accepted a US proposal aimed at ending hostilities in exchange for a cessation of strikes on Beirut's southern suburbs. Such a scenario is crucial to the peace process with Iran, which still appears to be stalled, after state media in Tehran said talks with the US had been suspended in protest at Israel's military offensive in Lebanon. Donald Trump insisted that negotiations were continuing at a rapid pace.
Police have released body cam footage of the moment officers handcuffed a student who had been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed to have been racially abused by him. Henry Novak, who was 18, was attacked in Southampton after a night out in December last year. He's seen on the ground in the video and can be heard saying, "I've been stabbed and I can't breathe," multiple times. His killer, Vikram Digba, has been told that he will serve at least 21 years for the murder. Mr. Novak's father, Mark, said his son's treatment had been inhumane and degrading. The Hampshire Police and Crime Commissioner is Donna Jones.
It's shocking footage. It's a shocking incident. Henry didn't appear to get the treatment he needed straight away because Vikram's brother had in fact cruelly lied to the police control room on that 999 call. That did lead to the complexity of those officers when they arrived on site. This is subject to an IOPC investigation, and I will be reviewing and ensuring that any recommendations are implemented.
More details of the crimes carried out by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell are expected to be revealed in court today. After his guilty plea, a statement or narrative agreed between the prosecution and the defence is to be read out at the High Court in Edinburgh. Murrell, the estranged husband of the former First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, admitted spending party funds on luxury items, including watches, jewellery and a motorhome. South West Water is due to be sentenced after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption to customers in Devon. It was linked to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in May 2024, with 143 confirmed cases and 4 people taken to hospital. The company could now face a multi-million pound fine, as our South West England correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
On May the 14th, 2024, South West Water told residents in the Hillhead area of Brixham that their tap water was safe to drink, despite confirmed cases of cryptosporidiosis. The illness is caused by a tiny parasite, which triggers stomach problems and diarrhoea. The following day, there was a U-turn. Around 17,000 households were told they had to boil their water. The company said overnight testing had found traces of the parasite in the supply.
A 24-hour strike by some workers on the London Underground system has begun. Members of the RMT union are in dispute about plans for a voluntary 4-day working week. And the first round of strikes in April caused major disruption on the tube network. New research suggests around a third of the British public now think a university degree is no longer worthwhile. According to the British Social Attitudes Survey, the number thinking it'll leave them better off in the long run has declined. An inquiry by MPs into the student loan system in England begins today amid concern about high graduate debt levels. Gemma, who's 33 and works in the tech sector, says the interest on her student loan now exceeds her repayments, but she still feels university was worth it.
For me, it has, because I wouldn't have been able to get the job that I have now without having gone to university. Where I'm from, people like me don't really come out with a big career, I guess, unless you do things like go to university. However, the finances behind it have been tricky to navigate. It feels like I'm kind of climbing a mountain, but I can't reach the top.
Universities UK says more effort is being made to help prepare students to find jobs.
7 minutes past six is the time. Thank you for that. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Helen Willits at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Helen.
Hello there, Justin, and good morning. Some rain, much needed rain, has fallen through the night and continues to fall this morning. Let's start where the rain is, southeast England, East Anglia, because there will be some tricky conditions on the roads. Lots of spray around for the next couple of hours through the morning rush. It's really quite heavy, even the odd rumble of thunder we've had, but it clears away. By the end of the morning rush, things brighten up, be a little bit of sunshine, but also quite a rash of showers as we go through into the afternoon. Nevertheless, 20 or 21 is our high. Believe it or not, around average for the time of year, not the sizzling weather, of course, we had last week. Now, the rest of England and Wales have already seen that rain clear away, but there are showers already gathering towards western areas, and those showers will turn heavier, more numerous, rumbles of thunder, gusty winds, 17 to 19 here today. Northern Ireland will have a day of sunny spells but slow moving showers because there's less wind around to shift those showers on very quickly. So hail and thunder certainly within 17 degrees, I think the high here. And to Scotland, where we've also got the rain lingering. It's quite foggy around the coast at the moment because the winds are lighter. So that cloud is hitting the ground and making it quite foggy. And the rain will tend to pep up a bit, actually, across northern and eastern areas into the Northern Isles as well through the day. So the west will be best for any bright or sunny spells. But here there'll be heavy showers around. So again, with hail and thunder, temperatures 15, 16 in the rain, up to 18, perhaps in the central belt with some sunshine. Another mild night to come tonight, more rain tomorrow.
Thank you very much indeed, Helen. It is just coming around to 9 minutes past six now, so time to take a first look at the morning papers. And it won't surprise you that the latest documents released by the government relating to Lord Mandelson really feature prominently on many of the front pages this morning. The Guardian says they show that he was given private briefings by the heads of the intelligence agencies while still undergoing security vetting. The Times reports that Lord Mandelson set up meetings between ministers and his lobbying company before his appointment was finalised. The Daily Mail refers to the PM as a poisonous puppet master, noting the Svengali-like influence he exerted on the government and his withering contempt for the man who leads it.
The Daily Mirror says the messages have revealed Peter Mandelson's extraordinary treachery. The Eye paper says the messages show how quickly some of Sir Keir Starmer's key allies lost faith in his ability to lead the government. The paper also claims that the peer was advised by civil servants to give artificial information about his personal and business connections to vetting staff in order to obtain security clearances.
The Daily Express says Pat McFadden's published message that backbench MPs are only interested in who we can tax in order to pay benefits to others will haunt the party for the rest of the parliament and beyond. It compares it to the note left by Liam Byrne for the coalition government in 2010, which said there is no money left.
The Financial Times says the release of the documents further undermines the Prime Minister, shows Lord Mandelson sought to wield influence far beyond his role. The Telegraph's editorial notes of Lord Mandelson's appointment as US ambassador: rarely has a single personnel decision had such serious repercussions for a political leader. The Sun's editorial concludes voters deserve to know the truth, however depressing. Yesterday, they got it.
And one other story in the tabloids this morning, mainly the former England captain Kevin Keegan's admission that he has had a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. The Mirror praises his warmth, humour and honesty in making the news public. And the Star hails his courage in announcing the news too, calling him the definition of a football icon.
11 minutes past six is the time. As we heard in the news, there's been a sustained nighttime attack by Russia on the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. And until relatively recently, that attack was still going on. Let us cross to Vitaly Shevchenko, our correspondent who is in Kiev. Tell us what you can, Vitaly, about the attack and about what you witnessed.
Well, it was a sleepless night for most residents of the Ukrainian capital and us as well. We were sheltering in a basement of a hotel in central Kiev, and in the middle of the night we heard more than 12 really, really loud bangs caused by Russian missiles, I believe, followed by at least one Russian drone buzzing overhead, and it seemed to be looking at the aftermath of the missile strikes. Then Ukrainian air defences tried to shoot down that drone with what sounded like machine gun fire. So it was a pretty bad night for the Ukrainian capital. At the moment of speaking, four people had been confirmed dead here in Kiev, and the and rescue workers are still sifting through the rubble in different locations across Kiev. Elsewhere in Ukraine, in the central city of Dnipro, six people were killed, including a rescue worker who had arrived at the site of an earlier attack, and then the Russians attacked again, killing the rescue workers. This is an attack that Ukrainians had been expecting since Russia threatened to mount a campaign of relentless strikes targeting specifically the Ukrainian capital. So hundreds of people last night were sheltering in basements and metro stations here in Kiev.
And that threat and these attacks very much in response to what has been seen as real Ukrainian successes in recent times, certainly in hitting Russian assets far inside Russia.
Last month, Ukraine gained more land than Russia, and Ukrainians have started a campaign of targeting Russia's logistics routes, particularly one really crucial road from Russia's city of Rostov to the occupied Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea, where we're now seeing petrol shortages, for example. So for Russia, it's becoming much more difficult to sustain their military campaign in southeastern Ukraine.
Vitaly Shevchenko in Kiev. Thank you.
Just coming round to 14 minutes past six, President Trump says he's negotiated an agreement for Israel to not attack Beirut and for Hezbollah to hold its fire against northern Israeli communities. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told me the latest.
Donald Trump says that there is an agreement to de-escalate the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. Lebanon said Hezbollah had accepted the US plan for a mutual cessation of attacks. Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel was on board too, with the caveat that its military operations would continue as planned if Hezbollah failed to stop attacking Israeli cities and citizens. Now, all of this came about after Donald Trump said that he had had a very productive call with Mr. Netanyahu, ending with an agreement that no troops would be going to Beirut. Mr. Trump also said that he'd had a conversation with representatives of Hezbollah's leadership. Mr. Trump said the call was very good and led to the agreement that all shooting would stop. In fact, he expressed the hope that it would mark the end of fighting for eternity. So if there is to be a truce, and there have been some clashes overnight, but if there is to be a truce, this is key to the jigsaw that is involved in making progress with Iran. Although yesterday, Tehran, through state media, said that talks with the US had been suspended in protest at Israel's military offensive in Lebanon.
Yeah, so if President Trump has fixed, let's say, as he thinks he has, the situation with Lebanon, or at least in terms of what Iran might object to in a wider ceasefire deal, where does that leave those talks, those ongoing negotiations, Peter?
Well, we're still getting mixed signals from the president. Certainly over the last day, increasingly confusing and prone to change at a moment's notice. In the space of a few hours on Monday, he gave an interview to NBC in which he said, "I don't care if peace negotiations with Iran are over." He was asked if the Iranians had told him that they were not going to negotiate further. And he said, "No, they haven't." But he added, "I think we've been talking too much, if you want to know the truth." He said, "I think going silent will be very good." And then in a post on Truth Social, he said talks with Iran were continuing at a rapid pace. And in an interview with ABC, he said he thinks there'll be an agreement with Iran to extend the ceasefire and reopen the Strait of Hormuz over the next week, which is clearly what his close supporters, indeed across America, it is what people want to hear, that the Strait of Hormuz is open. I think it's going to take some time for oil prices, if that happens or when that happens, for oil prices to come down and for it to filter through in terms of affecting petrol prices here. But that is the gripe that I am hearing every day from Americans who are becoming increasingly impatient with this war, the reason why it started, and its implications.
Peter Bowes with the latest. Thank you.
And that brings us to 17 minutes past six. The AI firm Anthropic, the company behind Claude, is going to list on the stock market in what could be one of the biggest such flotations in history. Will is here with more on that and indeed the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Anna. Yes, there's never been a $1 trillion initial public offering, IPO, listing of shares, but we could have three companies by the end of the summit. 2 weeks ago, Elon Musk's SpaceX revealing their plans to list on the stock market. ChatGPT maker OpenAI looks all but certain to do so this summer, and now, as of last night, Anthropic following suit, submitting paperwork to the US regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission, kicking off a process that could see it join Wall Street by the summer. Tinika Frika, senior fund manager at W1M, is with us here in the studio, and Professor Sana Karagani is chief strategy officer of Era 4, UK based AI infrastructure company, and the former head of the UK government office for AI. Morning, both. Tinika, first of all, a wave of these IPOs coming then. What do you make of the Anthropic move?
Yeah, morning. Well, I think the main thing that we are really looking forward to is actually look at the prospectus that they put out, because what we all reading is these companies raising billions and billions of dollars to invest in AI. And what we're interested to, you know, what money is actually being made on that? What's the profit that they are making? So no doubt it'll be a multi-hundred pages kind of document, but that's what we will be looking for. And as we go along, obviously, we sort of search for if their customers are actually buying a lot from them and if they are making money on them as well.
Professor Karagani, those are going to be some of your questions when you get your hands on the prospectus too.
Good morning. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you said in your opening, they're all going to IPO this year. So I don't expect, you know, a clear winner just from this specific move. But I think what we are going to get is a precedence, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to kind of a gauntlet laid down for metrics that might matter. So maybe showing enterprise revenue rather than subscriber counts, or, you know, hard numbers rather than philosophy. But I think the key here will be that going first also carries a bit of a risk, right? Because if things don't go exactly as you planned, or if the expectations of the capital markets aren't met, then you're leaving the door open for the people who come after you.
Right, interesting. So we've got these sort of announcements of intentions, but actually what order everybody comes in of these three companies you think still might be important too?
I think so. I think there's a little bit of precedent setting, and I think it's important. You know, this is an interesting move by Anthropic, because they are showing results that are, at least, you know, from what we hear, we haven't seen, that are a little bit different than their competitors. So it'll be interesting to see what they put, the papers that they put out.
Tinica, Professor Karigani talking about the revenue, the numbers kind of trumping everything. Is that true? Are there investors out there who are won over by Dario Amodei, the boss of Anthropic in particular, his push to say, we're safe, we're safer, we are open, we are willing to share our data? I mean, there's billboards all over Silicon Valley, aren't there, about how they consider themselves more responsible than others. One, I suppose, are investors buying that? And two, if they are, does it matter?
I mean, I think for people who worry about the safety of AI, it's definitely an important thing. However, I think one of the things that I think you know, we see more of from Anthropic is that they're launching very specific uses for their models. So there is Claude for legal, there's Claude for financial services, there's Claude for health services. So they have very specific industry products that are actually being used by customers. So I think because whenever we're in a start of an innovation in technology, it's all about, well, how is it going to be used? Who's going to use it? And how much are they going to pay for it? You know, is money being made? So from that point of view, Anthropic, sort of their products, their Claude range, feels a bit more practical maybe than others.
So actually, Professor, getting away from what people will know from a lot of these companies so far, the large language models, as they're called, the chatbots themselves, and actually to the utility of their products.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is the application there, right? This is, you know, how are we, and what Claude has been showing, or sorry, what Anthropic has been showing with their use cases is enterprise revenue, right? Rather than here's a number of users that have been our weekly users' numbers going up. The other thing is obvious, of course, that these are very rich companies already. So Anthropic just closed a $65 billion funding round. But what an IPO will do is will inject a huge amount of more money into their treasure troves. And that means that these that companies like Anthropic will then have the capital to make it easier for them to invest more, grow faster, and acquire other companies. Yeah. So they can, you know, continue to increase the applications that are built on top of their large language.
And on that, with your sort of former government hat on, I guess, is that something where regulators will be looking at this period through the summer of these IPOs too, about the scale that these companies are getting to, and I guess as opposed to the scale of other companies in the space, that competition sort of is completely squeezed out, that we've got something that we keep hearing is going to be totally transformational in the hands of a handful of companies at the end of all of this?
Well, yes. I mean, I think they've been looking that way at these companies, these frontier labs, for a while now, right? Because these labs, they are, some of them are, you know, as big as a small country, right? In terms of their sizes, but they also need a lot of infrastructure. So infrastructure in terms of data centers, in terms of energy, and in terms of water. And so if these acquisitions start to include some of that, we have to think about, you know, what's the best way to safeguard against companies that are basically owning the same type of infrastructure as a small country.
Professor Sana Kerigani, Chief Strategy Officer at Era4, and as I mentioned, former head of UK Government Office for AI. Thanks so much for your time. Tenneke, let's turn to a more domestic stock market story briefly, because EasyJet batting away during the programme yesterday, potential takeover, but doesn't seem the end of it, despite them calling it speculative.
Yeah, no, that's right. So EasyJet shares were up about 10% yesterday, and a US company called Castle Lake, who has been involved in European airline assets before, announced that they have a stake of over 2% and that they're considering buying it. Sort of EasyJet calls it opportunistic, which is true. It is also true that most bids are opportunistic. It's also how investors look at things. You try to ideally buy companies when their good value. And EasyJet is amongst the, you know, many airlines that have really been hurt by the Iran conflict, as fuel costs are going up and the you know, there's obviously some uncertainty about certain flight destinations as we travel more towards the Middle East. And for low-cost airlines, they don't have a wide margin for these sort of, you know, fewer bumps on seats and higher costs to run. So, yes, so their share price have come down from £5 to £4.
Yeah, makes them a target, doesn't it? An interesting story to keep following on the programme. Tenneke, thanks so much for your time. Tenneke Frieker, the Senior Fund Manager at W1M there. Now, we've talked a lot on the programme, haven't we, about Guinness's remarkable change in fortune from being an older man's drink, I guess, to becoming the pint of choice for many younger people. Its success, perhaps unsurprisingly, has led to a push for a bit of a share of its growth. Heineken and others pushing forward competitors in the market. So are we set for a summer of stout wars? Sir Tim Martin, the Chairman and Founder of JD Weatherspoon, joins us. Tim, morning.
Morning, Will.
And you were telling the FT you're wading into a bit of this. You've got a few of these on now. How many stouts are you going to have on in most of your pubs?
Well, for 47 years, we've only had one, so we're increasing it by 100% to two and bringing in Murphy's, which is number two in Ireland, and you will be pleased to know number one in Cork. So the British market will find out what number one in Cork means in the UK. Well, we hope it means a big increase in sales, but we will see.
Well, is there room for two or three? Let's chuck some others in there as well. Beamish, another Irish one, also owned by Heineken. Jeremy Clarkson's got one, Hawkston as well. Is there room for multiple stouts, especially when it's been this hot?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the stout sales, and it's all Guinness for us, have doubled. They've done tremendously well since pre-COVID. And it's now the number one draft drink in the UK. So I would think that that means that there is room for more. And indeed, there are more in quite a lot of pubs. So yes, the category has expanded, which you've seen before with gin. Pre-COVID, it was a very, very big drink then. And you see it in a typical pub with bitters or lagers. So there's definitely room for more than one. And we hope that Guinness sales don't suffer.
Yeah, well, speaking of the kind of summer and sales, heard lots, haven't we? Talked endlessly, really, for a year and a bit about the pressure hospitality's under. What's your kind of, I guess, mood, your level of confidence heading into the summer?
Well, I think it's a long game. And what's happened is since the millennium, 25, 26 years, pubs have lost no less than 50% of their sales to supermarkets. So what used to be a British and Irish culture of people going out for a pint as opposed to drinking at home has started to change. We think it's largely because of the tax regime. Most people think it's a great pity if pubs continue to decline. It's a massive loss of trade to supermarkets.
And it seems to be having an impact too on employment, right, as well. And I just wonder what your take was on the NEET figures that we were talking about on the program last week. That's these young people not in education, training or work.
Yes, well, it costs quite a lot to have a pint in a pub, and the government is trying to push up, understandably perhaps, the last couple of governments tried to push up wages. It's very difficult for governments to do that. It leads to inflation. In the 1970s, it was called a wages prices spiral. And I think that's what you've got. And it tends to push trade towards supermarkets where the labour costs are much, much lower per pint.
Tim, thanks so much for your time this morning. So Tim Martin, the chairman and founder of JD Weatherspoon.
Thank you, Will. 28 minutes past six now. It's time for the sport. Jonathan Ledyard is here. Morning.
Good morning. The world number one, Aryna Sabalenka, continues to buck the trend of seeds being blown away at the French Tennis Open. She proved too strong last night for fellow four-time major champion Naomi Osaka. Sabalenka winning in straight sets, 7-5, 6-3, in the first women's singles match in the prime-time evening slot at Roland Garros for 3 years.
Yes, she's such a great player. Always tough battles against her, super aggressive tennis. I'm mostly happy the way I serve and that I was able to, you know, put all of that pressure back on her. And happy with the win. It was a very tough one. And wow, it's amazing to play the night session in front of you all.
It means Sabalenka through to the quarterfinals in Paris, where she'll next play the 25th seed Diane Schneider, looking to win her first title after losing last year's final to Coto Gauff. Meanwhile, just hours before that match, Serena Williams confirmed that she would indeed be making a comeback this year, having evolved out of tennis, remember that expression, with no mention of retirement in 2022. One of world sport's greatest names with 23 Grand Slam titles to her name will return to play doubles at Queen's Club, which starts next week. The 44-year-old has been given a wild card, and she'll partner the Canadian teenager Victoria Mboko. Tennis correspondent Russell Fuller can't wait.
If it has been a part of your life for as long as it was with the Williams sisters, she left the tour and had her second child, and she's been busy with lots of different business enterprises since then, but she obviously feels that she is fit enough to return and hungry to give it one more go.
Quarterfinals start today, the all-Ukrainian matchup between the Rome champion Elena Svitolina and the Madrid champion Marta Kostyuk, followed by the men's tournament favourite Alexander Zverev against the Spanish breakout star Rafa Nadal. Coverage, of course, BBC Sounds, 5 Live, Sports Extra. The Southampton owner Dragan Solak says he will not sack coach Tonda Eckhart, despite Eckhart authorising a spying campaign against rival championship clubs, which you may remember meant Southampton were expelled from the championship playoff final last month. The Serbian businessman told BBC Sport that the German had his full support.
I'm looking at him as a young man, 32 years old, extremely talented manager. And we have to look into the future. I think he deserves the second chance. I truly hope that he will learn from this experience and he will achieve an incredible career in his life.
New WhatsApp messages have revealed how Southampton planned a spying campaign against their championship rivals. Quote, a contrived, determined plan from the top down, according to the Independent Disciplinary Commission, which investigated the case. The full story, and it's extremely extraordinary, on BBC Sport Online.
Thank you, Jonathan.
BBC Radio 3 Unwind. Music to unwind your mind. Find your morning focus.
Welcome. We have some wonderful sounds to experience together.
Bring calm to your afternoon.
This is the Mindful Mix.
And drift off to a peaceful sleep at night.
Every time I hear this track, I just start breathing slower.
Just ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3 Unwind.
It is 28 minutes, just about, to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. And Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
Russia has carried out a wave of attacks across Ukraine, targeting cities with drones and ballistic missiles. Ukrainian officials say at least 10 people have been killed and dozens more injured. President Zelensky had said intelligence suggested Moscow would be preparing further large-scale attacks after Russia warned last week that it would carry out what it called systematic strikes on Ukraine. Clashes have continued in southern Lebanon, despite President Trump claiming that Israel and Hezbollah had agreed to halt attacks. Lebanon said Hezbollah had accepted a US-backed proposal that would see it stop firing on Israel in exchange for planned Israeli strikes on southern Beirut being called off. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed an agreement had been discussed, but warned strikes on Beirut would go ahead if Hezbollah attacks persisted. Police have released body cam footage showing officers handcuffing an 18-year-old student who had been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed to have been racially abused by him. Henry Novak was attacked in Southampton after a night out in December last year. In the footage, he can be heard repeatedly telling officers, "I've been stabbed and I can't breathe." His attacker, Vikram Digwa, has been sentenced to life imprisonment and ordered to serve a minimum of 21 years. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell are expected to be outlined in court today, following his guilty plea to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party. Prosecutors are due to set out an agreed narrative of the offences at the High Court in Edinburgh. Nicola Sturgeon, who is estranged from Murrell, says that he deceived and betrayed her when he used party funds to buy luxury goods, including watches, cars and a motorhome. And South West Water is due to be sentenced after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption to its customers in Devon. It was linked to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in May 2024, with 143 confirmed cases and four people taken to hospital. The company could now face a multi-million pound fine.
Thank you for that. Just coming up to 25 to 7. How much damage has the document drop yesterday done to the government? The drop, of course, of the Mandelson files, those messages sent to Peter Mandelson and indeed from him to various cabinet ministers and other officials. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief little correspondent. What's the feeling this morning, Henry?
I think the feeling is that in the spectrum of these things, it was done less damage to the government than certainly some senior people in government were fearing as they awaited publication yesterday. I mean, it's worth remembering the purpose in the eyes of the Conservatives and others who forced the government to publish these documents back in February was in part in the hope that it would shed new light on the circumstances of Peter Mandelson's appointment as UK ambassador to the US, something which Keir Starmer now acknowledges was one of his gravest mistakes. We didn't particularly get anything new about that at all in yesterday's documents. But we did get a much richer picture of at least a sort of slice of government and how it operated, of Peter Mandelson's own frustration, not just with Number 10, but actually also with the Foreign Office and the way in which foreign policy is made. And we also got a picture of Peter Mandelson as a man who was not only the UK ambassador to the US, but was consulted by cabinet ministers about a broader range of policy than just UK-US policy, by senior figures in Number 10, including on issues like who the Prime Minister's economic advisor should be, by Morgan McSweeney, the Prime Minister's former chief of staff, by fellow ambassadors. At times, he was also seeking to offer counsel, but was rebuffed. So, for example, there are messages that Peter Mandelson was sending Ed Miliband before he was the UK ambassador to the US, after Ed Miliband became energy secretary, which Ed Miliband sort of seemed to go various different shades of politely ignoring. And we also get, by the way, a picture of a man who really wanted to be Chancellor of Oxford University, because he spent a lot of time messaging Labour MPs who'd been to Oxford asking them to vote for him.
When it comes to the wider political impact, I mean, you look at what Pat McFadden, the Work and Pensions Secretary, said to him, particularly about Labour MPs, Labour backbench MPs, and what their mood was and what their feeling was about policy towards welfare. That sort of thing potentially does have legs, doesn't it?
That exchange with Pat McFadden, I think, will have by far the longest political afterlife of anything in this document dump. Pat McFadden, just as a reminder, at the time he was a senior cabinet minister, he wasn't yet the Work and Pension Secretary, said to Peter Mandelson on WhatsApp about Labour backbenchers at the height of the welfare rebellion, "Every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others? They are asking the wrong question." And that has already been seized upon by Kemi Badenoch, who says Pat McFadden has said in private what he and the Prime Minister deny in public. And Pat McFadden is adamant that this is just a reflection privately of what his view is publicly. But what is so damaging potentially for the government, at least to its opponents to the right, is it's such a pithy summary of what Labour MPs think rather than what Pat McFadden himself thinks.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to 7. Will President Trump's assertion that Israel won't attack Beirut clear the path for ceasefire talks between the US and Iran to continue, whatever the status of those might be at the moment? It is normally quite hard to tell. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, is with us. Yolande, before we look at the situation in Iran, this is something that President Trump posted on Truth Social last night. Just tell us a bit more about what he has said will happen.
Well, I mean, President Trump talked about how he had a conversation with Benjamin Netanyahu and that as a result, he turned his troops around. They'd been planning a major raid of Beirut, he said. Thank you, Bibi, using Mr. Netanyahu's nickname. And he said that he'd also had a conversation with representatives of the leaders of Hezbollah who'd agreed to stop shooting at Israel and its soldiers. Likewise, Israel agreed to stop shooting at them. Now, a lot remains to be seen here, of course, but this actually seems to be more of a partial ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel agreeing to hold off strikes on Beirut. It said it was going to attack the southern suburbs seen as a Hezbollah stronghold. And Hezbollah is supposed to stop its cross-border attacks into northern Israel. Nevertheless, Israel, you know, reports this morning on Khan Radio, the public radio, saying that there were 20 rockets fired from Lebanon to northern Israel last night. A drone intercepted as well, with no casualties. Israel is continuing, of course, its ground operations in southern Lebanon. It's pushed further into Lebanon than it's been for 25 years, saying it's attacking Hezbollah infrastructure and operatives on the ground. And there are reports coming through that have not been confirmed yet this morning of another deadly Israeli attack on a car in Nabatea in southern Lebanon. So, you know, it still remains extremely fragile and volatile. Lebanon is due to hold more direct talks with Israel in Washington, and it's saying it's going to seek to extend the ceasefire. The New York Times actually has an interview with the prominent Lebanese politician close to Hezbollah, Nabi Berri, who's saying that Hezbollah is open to a new real ceasefire with Israel and suggesting only Donald Trump could pressure Israel to abide by one.
Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent, thank you.
It is 20 to 7. There's going to be more detail revealed in court today about how the former SNP chief executive and husband of the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, used embezzled party funds to buy a wide and strange array of goods, including, of course, that famous motorhome. Let us talk to James Cook, our Scotland editor, who is on the line. James, give us a sense of what is expected, actually. What is the process today and what's expected from it?
Yeah, strange is the word, isn't it, Justin? You're not wrong. It is a fairly odd mixture of luxuries on the one hand and mundanities on the other. And what do we expect at the High Court in Edinburgh today is what's called an agreed narrative between the Crown, the prosecution on one side, and the defence on the other. What we're going to basically get is some of the details that we might have heard had this gone to trial, although that would have been contested evidence at that point. But this is what they can agree on after the guilty plea last week from Peter Murrell. We don't know exactly what that will include, but we do know that Murrell falsified documents to cover his tracks, so we might get a bit more information about that. Might we perhaps get a glimpse into an indication of motive? That is possible. It was interesting in Nicola Sturgeon's interview with Laura Koonsberg at the weekend that she said that Murrell had never explained to her why she had committed the crimes, although she did say that when it came to that motorhome, that £125,000 motorhome that sat in her mother-in-law's drive in Fife, which she said she genuinely had no conscious memory of having seen, she said when she confronted him about that he said he had bought it because it might have been useful for taking people around the country to campaign in times of COVID safely. Now, that doesn't really explain. We've been, our colleagues, excellent data journalist colleagues that we have been going through the data, and doesn't really explain why he bought a guidebook to touring England and Wales in a camper van the day after he bought the camper van and went on to buy a couple of other similar guidebooks. So there's lots and lots of outstanding questions like that. And there are lots of questions about whether or not there needs to be some sort of inquiry. The former First Minister, Labour's Jack McConnell, among those calling for a joint parliamentary inquiry between Westminster and Holyrood, which has never been held before, to look at the wider circumstances. But that's still being resisted by the current First Minister, John Swinney.
James Cook, thank you.
It's 18 minutes to 7. MPs had a lot of speed reading to do on their first day back in Westminster after the half-term break. Hundreds of documents relating to the appointment of Peter Mandelson as the UK's ambassador to Washington were released yesterday ahead of that common statement about the files. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, looked relaxed as he waited on the green benches for his turn at the dispatch box. He chatted to the Government Chief Whip, Jonathan Reynolds, and at one point the two men showed each other their phones. Ministers and their messages would be a theme of the exchanges that followed. The Conservative MP, Dr. Luke Evans, had been hard at work.
Volume 2, Part 3, page 243.
He'd ploughed through the hundreds of documents that had been published earlier in the afternoon and had come across a text message from the then Cabinet Office Minister Pat McFadden to Peter Mandelson.
His predecessor states when talking about Labour MPs, every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others? Is that the same experience he's having in every meeting he now has?
This is the message that was heard, if not around the world, then at least loud and clear at Westminster. Not least because Pat McFadden is now the Work and Pension Secretary. Luke Evans got a one-word answer from Darren Jones. No. The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister told MPs there'd be a full Commons debate on Wednesday afternoon.
The documents we are publishing today are one of the largest government publications ever laid before this House. This disclosure process has been wide-ranging, costing the Cabinet Office alone over £1 million.
The Conservative Shadow Cabinet Office Minister Alex Burghardt complained that MPs hadn't been given enough time to go through all of the papers ahead of the statement. But he'd read enough to know that some ministers had not handed over their messages. And he thought it strange that Sir Keir Starmer didn't feature more prominently in the documents.
It was clear that due diligence was not followed. It is a failure that is visible from space. It is a failure that will define this Prime Minister's premiership. It is a failure that will be written as his political epitaph.
Yeah. For the Liberal Democrats, Lisa Smart complained about government by WhatsApp.
Senior ministers showed a staggering lack of judgment. Could the Chief Secretary explain why so much business relating to one of the most controversial public appointments in recent years appears to have been conducted over WhatsApp?
The Labour chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry, had been given early sight of the documents and thought something was missing.
There is no written evidence of any mitigations being put in place, either to minimise Peter Mandelson's conflicts of interest or, more importantly, to reduce the risk to our national security that vetting had flagged.
Ellie Chowns for the Greens thought the publication shone the light of disinfectant on the political culture.
Does the Minister agree with me that it is essential that this sorry episode in British political history leads to a fundamental change in political culture so that the voices of women and girls who survive abuse at the hands of people like Jeffrey Epstein are always listened to and put front and centre?
Plaid Cymru's Liz Saville-Roberts was unhappy at one insight into how the government worked.
It remains obvious that Epstein's victims simply weren't on the radar of the boys' club in control at number 10. Now, the minister can come to his place again and again and again, but how does he justify that culture that was in power at the time?
Darren Jones insisted that there were very senior women working in the Labour Party and the government, but he agreed that it was important that there was a diversity of view in the decision-making process. The SNP's Chris Law was one of a number of MPs to point out that Peter Mandelson had refused to hand over his messages.
How can the government guarantee that Parliament and the public have seen the full truth? And the Prime Minister, was the Prime Minister misled, or is the Prime Minister and the Chief Secretary accepting partial disclosure?
Darren Jones said the documents spoke for themselves and insisted the government had done all it could to provide full disclosure.
That was Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. Brings us to 13 minutes to 7. The state of California holds a primary election today to decide who the two candidates will be to run for the governorship in November. California governors can be big figures in US politics, but this year is different and weird. The big figures who could have run, like the former presidential hopeful Kamala Harris, have decided not to. I asked Mike Murphy, the former Republican strategist, why?
That is a great question, Justin, and a lot of people in California are asking the same thing. It is a daunting time here. The voters are unhappy. The state's wobbling. We have budget issues because the federal aid under Trump has been cut. And for whatever reason, the big marquee names decided not to run. So we have a bunch of lesser-known candidates, though the most known Democratic candidate is ultimately the one who kind of bubbled to the top as, I would say, an uninspiring but, you know, useful choice.
Tell us about him.
Well, his name is Xavier Becerra. He was state attorney general. He had been reelected from that post. He had been a member of Congress for well over a decade, representing the Los Angeles area. He had served in Joe Biden's cabinet. So he's one of these long resume guys. His supporters would say he's a good, reliable Democrat. He's Latino, which is a big part of the voting electorate here. He's steady. He's experienced. His critics would say he's had more than 20 years in public life and he's never left a footprint anywhere. And there was a big whispering campaign against him by former Biden people that he was by far the least effective cabinet member and a lightweight and all those things. But the big power centers in Democratic politics in California, which are one, the public employee unions, to Governor Newsom, who is publicly neutral, but he's got people scurrying around at night working on the election, and the Latino community all find him acceptable. One Newsom advisor told me, well, he's a C, but everybody else is a D or an F. So that's probably where it ought to land with Becerra.
And is it possible, likely even, that Steve Hilton gets onto the final runoff, as it were, that actually there is a Republican in the race and that it's him?
Yeah, quite likely. So the way the California system works, about eight and a quarter million people vote in the primary here in tomorrow in June. And everybody is on one ballot regardless of their party. They're named, you know, they have a Republican or Democrat after their name. There are quite a few of them. And then if nobody gets to 50, the top two go on to slug it out in a two-way election in November. So this is the primary, but it's what we call jungle primary, everybody on one ticket. So what happens is you have five or six Democrats fighting over about two-thirds of the electorate habitually. And right now we have two Republicans fighting over a third of the electorate, which is why Hilton, who's in front among Republicans, has been urging his Republican competition, the only one he has, Sheriff Chad, you know, slap on the handcuffs Bianco, who's a real kind of conservative from Southern California, to drop out of the race to guarantee he, Hilton, as a Republican, makes it to the top two. Now, all the Democrats love this plan because they think Hilton would be easy to beat in the general election because this is an overwhelmingly Democratic state now, and Donald Trump is at a new low of popularity. So even with Bianco in, and Bianco's in Southern California, Hilton's in Northern California, but Hilton has identity from being on Fox News, the chances that it'll be Becerra and Hilton are quite high. The wild card is that another Democrat, billionaire Tom Steyer, who's running from the left and has spent well over $200 million of his own money, is able to edge Hilton out, and Hilton comes in a narrow third and gets locked out of the fall. That could happen, but that's the less likely scenario.
Final thought about wider American politics, and particularly the midterms looming in November, the thinking being that the Democrats win the House back, possibly even the Senate. And yet, with the Senate, is it fair to say there are some wobbles?
I would say that we're having a wave election, which is not uncommon in midterms where people express displeasure. And so it's very likely, even with the Republican redistricting tricks and now the Democratic redistricting tricks, that the Democrats will get control of the House. The Senate is tougher because many of the seats in play lean in normal times Republican, but the polling shows the Democrats are almost freakishly in the hunt in places like Alaska, where a Republican incumbent is in some trouble, Ohio, which leans Republican. So will they get all four seats they need? The Democrats take control? Possible, but not every Democratic race is going well. Their miracle candidate in Maine is in some trouble. Plattner, he's running against a longtime Republican incumbent, Susan Collins, who's quite wily. I think the thing to remember, though, in the House, when you're in the minority, you have no power. In the Senate, when you're in the minority, you have power. So if the Republicans go from controlling the Senate by four votes down to two, they still have majority, but it'll be very difficult to run the place because there are some unreliable Republicans like Rand Paul and Murkowski, who's a former Republican, now an independent, from also from Alaska, who are not reliable on a party whip vote. So effective control could turn into chaos, even if the Democrats don't win the Senate. The bottom line is, it is extremely likely that the Democrats will have more, significantly more political power after the midterm elections. And that, of course, will be an epic frustration to Donald Trump.
Mike Murphy, as ever, thank you.
7 minutes to seven now. How much better would your life be if all of those little things about it that annoy you could get fixed? Not enough time to get over a pedestrian crossing, maybe, before the lights change. Too many announcements on trains. Just the tiny details that make us cross and bring down our mood as a result of that. One former European Parliament researcher has launched a website for people to suggest their quibbles, says he'll attempt to sort them out. So how much of a difference to our mindset would the end of small annoyances make? Jonathan Deliser is behind Quibble. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, good morning.
How do you fix these things? What sort of power and control do you have to make it happen?
Yeah, well, I think in order to do effective work on this kind of campaign, you need a couple of things. One is technical know-how on how decisions get made and how policy works. And the second is leverage of some kind. So I think in our case, that's going to be the audience that we're able to pull together. And yeah, I mean, the response that we've had in the last day has been overwhelming. I mean, yesterday we had hundreds of messages, and it really seemed to resonate with people that there is this, that we experience nuisances in our lives, and that, that we want recourse towards fixing these. And, you know, you think about, I mean, one of our flagship Quibble campaigns will be the cookie banner that we all have to press on every web page. And, you know, each time only takes a few seconds, so it's, you know, it's not a big deal. We all just get on with it. But when you think about the fact that millions of us are having to press it, you know, on average 5 times a day, it starts to add up. And I think, becomes something that's worth trying to fix. And the European Commission worked out that it was estimated it was costing EU citizens 340 million hours per year.
Well, David Halpern is listening to that, director of the Downing Batcock Institute, Cambridge, president emeritus of the Behavioural Insights team. David, I mean, again, I suppose it comes back to the power and the control. If things are being done by, well, in the case of pop-ups, it's a legal thing, isn't it? A legal requirement. Or you've got things that are run by councils, things that are run by private companies. Do we really have the ability to change those small things that annoy us?
Yeah, there's, I think we have more ability than people often realise to reshape these things. There's an old literature actually that compared the effect of kind of big, major life events to just day-to-day hassles. And it turns out actually the day-to-day hassles have quite a big impact, often bigger than the sort of the one-off events. So I think there's lots of things that we can, in principle, do. And there have been previous attempts by governments to do it. You can think right back to the John Major Cohn's hotline, you know, which was much ridiculed. But I think today, because so much more capacity for many people to respond in more fluid digital ways, it opens up all kinds of new possibilities like this.
It's interesting, as you say, that the idea that these big, you know, the sort of life events that you would think would wipe you out, that we're actually more resilient to cope with than the just daily grind of stuff that just eats away at us.
That's right. They kind of just grind you down. We did some estimates to work out how much time people just spend doing also just really boring things. I mean, the example actually of cookies is a good one. You learn to ignore it. But we estimate it's about an hour a day that people have to do kind of just really annoying, crappy things that they don't really want to be doing. And can we just get rid of that? And then similarly, a key thing which something like Quibble can do, or it's an early on geographic, Google Fix My Street, some might know, but you don't know who to call. It's an annoying thing. Well, who would you call? So to be able to go to a general site and just, this is a really annoying thing, and a platform like that can figure out whose desk it should end up on.
It can also feel a bit like nobody other than you cares about these things. And that's a bit of an issue as well, where you think, well, you know, the companies or whoever's in charge, they're not bothered, they're not interested. And that kind of grounds you down as well.
Well, a collective moan. Who doesn't like a collective moan? Stuck on the train, suddenly everyone will get sociable, don't they? So that's true. And one of the things also is it gets you out. It's not just you, but you can then start to find solutions. There's some examples in other countries which are really nice, where people identify the problem, and then someone else who's involved in it also just solves it. Like as another neighbour or someone else, and actually we can fix that.
Yeah, and it helps the community, I suppose, as well. David Halpern, Jonathan Deliser, thank you.
It has just come out to 2 minutes to seven. A new series starts next week, looking at where we are 10 years after Britain voted to leave the EU.
The result of the Brexit referendum came as a huge shock for member states.
I'm Alex Forsyth, and all next week I'm examining the impact of Brexit a decade after the referendum.
The UK moved ahead on gene editing, where we were constrained by EU rules. There's a question mark whether the EU will catch up.
From science and academia to the economy, the union and immigration.
Initially, people absolutely did not get what they voted for in the sense that there was a clear promise that net migration would come down and instead it tripled.
10 years after Brexit, next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
The weather has really changed now from that nice sunshine we were enjoying, hasn't it, Helen Willetts?
It's very different, isn't it, Anna? And straight on with that very different weather, because across East Anglia and the South East, it's actually pouring it down at the moment, and many parts of England and Wales have seen at least 10 millimetres of rain through the evening and overnight, but some as much as 20 to 30 millimetres, a good inch, a great drink of water for the gardens. But all that clears away through the next couple of hours. We'll see some tricky driving conditions for a while. And then it's sunny spells and scattered heavy showers with rumbles of thunder and some hail and gusty winds. So temperatures around about 16 to 20 today across England and Wales. Now for Northern Ireland, it's slow moving showers. The main rain band has cleared away. There's some brightness. There'll be some sunshine. But again, the showers are likely to be quite heavy, even thundery, particularly this morning. They might ease in intensity later on, highs of around 17. And for Scotland, well, the rain is going to linger in northern and eastern areas, turn heavier for a time. For further south and west, sunny spells and showers eventually. But we've got some fog around at the moment around the coast, for example. That should lift a break, a little bit of sunshine coming through. But highs today about 18 in the central belt, about 15 where we have the rain. More later.
Helen, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday the 2nd of June. The headlines this morning, at least 10 people have been killed in a wave of Russian attacks across Ukraine. We will hear from a Ukrainian MP in Kyiv after the news. And President Trump says Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to a partial ceasefire, but clashes have continued either side of Lebanon's southern border.
Also in the next hour, research suggests one in three British people now think a university degree isn't worth the time and the money. We'll find out if three young people agree at 10 to 8. And one giant leap for the world's first disabled astronaut.
When I was a kid, I never actually dreamt of being an astronaut. I don't necessarily fit that typical picture of what we all grew up thinking that astronauts look like.
We'll hear from Paralympic athlete and wannabe spaceman John McFall. The BBC News is read this morning by Charles Carroll.
Russia has carried out a large wave of attacks across Ukraine, using more than 650 drones and more than 70 ballistic missiles. Officials in the capital, Kyiv, say four people have been killed there and more than 50 injured, including several children. Local authorities in the eastern city of Dnipro say that six people have died in attacks there. Moscow last week warned that it would launch systematic strikes on Ukraine. From Kyiv, Vitaly Shevchenko sent this report.
From our shelter in central Kyiv, we could feel the building shake and hear loud bangs as several strikes made impact. The buzz of drones could also be heard, as well as the sound of Ukraine's air defense systems. The whole extent of the damage is unclear yet, but Kyiv's mayor Vitaly Klitschko says that two high-rise apartment blocks have been hit. Blackouts and fires have also been reported in parts of the city. Elsewhere in Ukraine, an industrial facility has been attacked in Zaporizhia, and seven people, including an 11-year-old girl, have been wounded in Kharkiv, according to the local authorities.
Clashes have continued in southern Lebanon, despite a claim by President Trump that Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to stop fighting. Lebanon said last night that Hezbollah had accepted a US plan for a truce. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed the agreement, but warned that strikes on Beirut would go ahead if firing by Hezbollah went on. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Donald Trump claimed that he'd persuaded both Israel and Hezbollah to de-escalate their conflict. In a post on his Truth Social platform, the US president said after a very productive call with Benjamin Netanyahu, no troops would be going to Beirut, and that Hezbollah, after what he said was a conversation with representatives of the group's leadership, had agreed that all shooting would stop. Mr. Trump expressed the hope that it would mark the end of fighting for eternity. Lebanon said it had accepted a US proposal aimed at ending hostilities in exchange for a cessation of strikes on Beirut's southern suburbs. Such a scenario is crucial to the peace process with Iran, which still appears to be stalled, after state media in Tehran said talks with the US had been suspended in protest at Israel's military offensive in Lebanon. Donald Trump insisted that negotiations were continuing at a rapid pace.
Police have released body cam footage of the moment officers handcuffed a student who had been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed to have been racially abused by him. Henry Novak, who was 18, was attacked in Southampton after a night out in December last year. His killer, Vikram Digwar, has been told that he will serve at least 21 years for his murder. You may find the sound of the video distressing. Aruna Iyengar reports.
In the body cam footage, which was played in court, Henry Novak, a student at Southampton University, was heard telling police that he'd been stabbed. His plea was ignored. Officers arrested him and put him in handcuffs.
What's happened to you, all right? You've been stabbed? Whereabouts? I don't think you have, mate.
The last sound was of Mr. Novak being handcuffed. As this was happening, his attacker, Vikram Digwar, tried to frame himself as a victim, falsely claiming that he'd been racially attacked. Donna Jones, the Hampshire Police and Crime Commissioner, said it was devastating that officers did not believe Henry, adding that the case raised serious concerns about police impartiality, fairness and judgment.
More details of the crimes carried out by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell are expected to be revealed in court today. Murrell, the estranged husband of the former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, pleaded guilty last week to spending party funds on luxury items. She says that he deceived her and she knew nothing of his crimes. Here's our Scotland editor, James Cook.
Peter Murrell's illicit haul extended to more than 1,000 items over 12 years. The most expensive, purchased in 2020, was a £125,000 motorhome. The next day, he ordered a campervan travel guide to England and Wales. He also bought expensive watches, fountain pens and coffee machines. Now, following Murrell's guilty plea, a statement or narrative agreed between the prosecution and the defence is to be read out at the High Court in Edinburgh, giving more details about his crimes. There are now calls from both inside and outside the party for a parliamentary inquiry into the case.
Southwest Water is due to be sentenced today after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption, which was linked to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in Devon in 2024. There were 143 confirmed cases and 4 people were taken to hospital in Brixham as a result of a waterborne parasite, which is found in animal and human fecal matter. The company could now face a multi-million pound fine. Howard Heather was among those taken ill.
Violent diarrhoea and sickness and barely conscious for a lot of the time, which is partly due to the fact I'm diabetic and my blood sugars were sort of out of control. Took quite a long time to get over, but as far as I'm aware, I have no lasting effects from it now.
Hundreds of people have blocked roads and burnt tyres in a town in central Kenya to protest against American plans for an Ebola isolation centre. The demonstrators believe preparations for the quarantine facility at a US military base are continuing, despite a High Court ruling last week that they should be paused. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is in China for a series of meetings with her Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The discussions are expected to focus on the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East. Our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, reports from Beijing.
While this two-day visit by the Foreign Secretary represents a further thawing of relations between Britain and China, there remain sensitive issues for Yvette Cooper to broach with her counterparts here in Beijing. At her first meeting at the Great Hall of the People, Vice President Han Zheng used his opening remarks to say that ongoing political conflicts were dealing a heavy blow to world peace and stability. Ms. Cooper responded, saying that frank and constructive conversations could help China and the UK make progress despite their areas of disagreement. Russia's most recent deadly missile and drone attacks on Ukraine and Israel's continuing assaults in Lebanon are likely to feature in discussions. Yvette Cooper will also travel to the southern city of Shenzhen, where the focus is expected to be much more on robotics, AI and new technology.
New research suggests that around a third of the British public now think a university degree is no longer worthwhile, with the figure rising dramatically over the past 20 years. An inquiry by MPs into the student loan system in England begins today amid concern about high debt levels. The government says the current finance system protects lower-earning graduates. Here's our education editor, Branwyn Jeffries.
Figures from the British Social Attitudes Survey give a 20-year perspective on how public faith in the value of a university degree has declined as the costs and number of graduates have risen. The research suggests that last year, 34% of people in the UK thought a degree wasn't worth the time or money. In 2005, the figure was 14%. MPs on the Treasury Committee will today begin hearing evidence as part of their investigation into student loans in England, following growing pressure from graduates over the repayment threshold and the interest rate, in a sign of the strength of feeling. More than 50,000 written submissions have already been made.
A 24-hour strike by some workers on the London Underground system has begun. Members of the RMT union are in dispute about plans for a voluntary four-day working week. The first round of strikes in April caused major disruption on the tube network.
Thank you, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven now. Russia's defence ministry says it has achieved all of its objectives in a wave of strikes on Ukrainian cities overnight. At least 10 people have been killed, including several of them in the capital, Kyiv. You might remember Moscow warned last week that it would step up the intensity of its strikes after it claimed Ukrainian drones attacked a dormitory, killing a number of Russian students. Well, Alexei Gonkarenko is a Ukrainian MP, member of the Ukrainian delegation to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Alexei Goncharenko.
Thank you for joining us. You are in Kyiv. What have you seen and heard overnight?
That was an awful night, and there was a huge Russian missile and drone attack, probably one of the biggest during the war. And if to speak about using hypersonic missiles, it's the largest attack. A lot of destruction. And again, a lot of civilian infrastructure, it was hit and civilian areas damaged, and just usual civilian people were killed. So everything continues, Russian terror continues. They try to threaten Ukraine. But the thing is, the question is how the world will react on such awful attacks.
How do you think the world will react?
I think the world should increase pressure on Russia. I think the world should stop Russian shadow fleet, which still moves in the waters, stop the refineries which are buying Russian oil. The war can be stopped. The war in Ukraine can be stopped very easily and quickly because Ukraine is ready to end the war right now on the current lines. And just Russia refuses to do this. And they refuse because they still have incomes and their war chest is filled with oil money, which can be changed very easily and quickly if the world will make decisive steps. Fortunately, we don't see these steps, and quite opposite. Recently, United Kingdom made some steps for easing in sanctions on Russian oil products, and for example, it was a very bad signal, and that's something I think both morally and strategically, because we need to stop this war.
Do you feel like the attention and the impetus from world leaders has been drawn away by other conflicts, things like the Middle East, for example, and their attention is not on Ukraine at the moment?
I think we can say this, yes, especially when we're speaking about United States. United States now definitely completely absorbed by what's going on in the Middle East. And in reality, the negotiations which were started by President Trump last year, they have no result for the moment. And yes, we feel, I would be frank with you, we feel abandoned. We will continue to fight. For us, it's existential. But I think the world really should step in and stop this suffering and stop these killings and stop this next escalation, which is happening right now.
In terms of that escalation, what is the level of concern, given the abandonment, the feeling of abandonment, as you describe it, what is the level of concern about the increased intensity of these Russian attacks?
We clearly understand that if Russia will have possibility, they would kill all of us. They can't conquer the country, but they try to flatten the country and to make it like to desert this country and to kill as many people as possible. And just we shouldn't forget that it's also technologically very dense area, nuclear power plants, hydro stations, a lot of chemical production and manufacturing. And the results of what Russia is doing can be felt by every person on Earth if it will go bad. And the longer it continues, higher are chances that sooner or later something absolutely horrible will happen. Once again, we need to stop Russia. We need to stop this terror as soon as possible. The world has means to do this, but unfortunately, it looks like it doesn't have the will to do this, at least for the moment.
Alexei Goncharenko, a Ukrainian MP in Kyiv this morning. Thank you.
13 minutes past seven is the time. The messages between Peter Mandelson and various ministers revealed yesterday are embarrassing for the government, no doubt about that. And many, of course, suggested that they would be. But are they anything more than that? Have they revealed anything important other than the perils of WhatsApp for politicians? Let us talk to Alex Burkhardt, the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, who is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
Is there something missing, do you think, from them that ought to be in them?
I think it's clear that there's a lot of stuff that's missing, right? There's anybody who's looked at these 1,500 pages will see acres and acres of white space, these sort of constellations of asterisks, huge amounts of redactions. Now, some of that is sort of fine because it's national security issues. It's stuff that we were dealing with our relationship with the Americans. But there are also it's also clear there's a lot of material that wasn't published. And we know that because all ministers were asked to hand over their WhatsApp messages between them and Peter Mandelson. And lots of ministers, some very senior people, have handed over a nil return. There are almost no exchanges between the Prime Minister and Peter Mandelson. There are no exchanges between people like Peter Kyle, who were very close allies of Peter Mandelson. And so it's clear that stuff has been deleted or has gone missing. And it would be great to see that.
Just on that, you're suggesting, are you, that the Prime Minister had messages with Peter Mandelson that are not, should not be redacted, they could be seen, but are not here. I mean, who do you think has taken the decision not to put them into the public realm, and what comeback, if any, is there?
Well, I suspect that if they haven't been handed over, they've been deleted. And Gavin Williamson from the Conservative benches yesterday asked Darren Jones, the Labour minister, whether the Prime Minister had deleted any of his messages. And the government minister couldn't answer the question. But it beggars belief that there were so few exchanges between Mandelson and the Prime Minister. There's almost nothing in the record. So either this stuff is being deliberately withheld, or it's been deleted. But in answer to your question, Justin, yes, it's obvious that there is still stuff that's missing. Whether we ever see it or not, I don't know.
And yet, I mean, we've just been talking about Ukraine. We've got Iran. We've got all manner of desperate things going on around the world, hugely impactful, important for this country. Do you not feel, actually, this has sort of rebounded on you as a party because you brought this day into being? You initially forced the government to do what it's done at a cost of £1 million. We haven't learned very much. It's a bit embarrassing for a few ministers. It will feel to a lot of people like, to put it mildly, not tackling, not talking about the things that really matter.
Look, we are talking about the things that really matter, and you'll hear Kemi Badenoch talk about the things that matter every day of the week, including, very most importantly, national security. And this is all about national security. The enormous amount of work the Conservative Party have put into exposing what went on has revealed that the Prime Minister was not thinking about national security when he appointed Peter Mandelson to our most senior diplomatic post. He was told, but we only know about this, Justin, because of the work the Conservative Party's done. He was told that Mandelson had maintained his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein after Epstein had gone to prison, that he had been the director of a Russian company that had supplied arms to Putin during Putin's invasion of Crimea, that he had maintained unhealthy business relations in China, and so on and so on and so on. And after that, he received that note the then cabinet secretary, Simon Case, told the prime minister, if you want to make this appointment, you get the security vetting done first. Mm. And the prime minister ignored that and went ahead and appointed Mandelson anyway. And we now know, because of the release yesterday, that Mandelson in January 2025 was sitting in Washington seeing highly classified documents despite having no security briefing. Right. This is a total abrogation of responsibility on national security grounds. And we only know that the government failed here because of the work that the Conservative Party's done.
I want to ask you as well about this terrible body cam footage that's been revealed, the arrest of Henry Novak. Nigel Farage said last night, it's the most shocking footage of discrimination you will ever see. A white boy handcuffed by police officers more concerned about accusation of racism than an act of murder. Do you agree with him?
I think, well, look, what happened in this case is it was absolutely abhorrent. I think it's really very upsetting. And I am worried that it suggests that something has gone wrong with the way in which certain parts of the police
think. But what?
That the assumption was that when a boy was lying on the ground saying, I've been stabbed, that the people who stabbed him were the victim. I think
because of the respective colours of their skin?
Well, if
which is what Mr Farage seems to be suggesting.
But if that's what happened, if that's what happened, then that is absolutely abhorrent. You know, that what we have to have in our country is a legal system which looks after people who have been stabbed and people who are victims. You know, that's what we all expect. So, look, there's going to be a lot of a very serious thought and discussion that follows this this case, and rightly so.
Alex Berger, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's 19 minutes past seven. Has the free trade agreement between the UK and India, signed in the summer of last year, hit a wall now? Will Bain is back with more on that.
Morning again, Anna. Yes, the business secretary who we heard referenced there, Peter Kyle, will be in Delhi, the government says, to progress the trading relationship to the next level after signing that free trade agreement. But you might remember back in October last year, we told you about a delegation of business leaders, finance, tech, etc., heading out to India with the Prime Minister to discuss exactly that. And yet still, no implementation yet. Well, one of those on the trip was Lord Karan Bilimoria, crossbench peer and chairman of the International Chamber of Commerce UK. Morning.
Good morning.
Are you worried that it's still not been implemented?
The negotiations for the UK-India Free Trade Agreement started in January 2022 when I was president of the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry. It took 3.5 years, 14 rounds of negotiations, and finally concluded in July last year when Prime Minister Modi and Prime Minister Starmer signed the agreement at Chequers. Now, I don't like the fact that the UK is referred to as a middle power. I mean, we are a country with a population of less than 70 million, less than 1% of the world's population. Yes, there are only two superpowers, the USA and China, but we're a country which is the fifth largest economy in the world in absolute terms. We've got global influence at the top table of the world, whether it's the UN, the G7, the G20, NATO, AUKUS, Five Eyes. India is the fifth largest economy in the world. Soon, India will be the third largest economy in the world and is an emerging global economic superpower. And yet, here's the fact, India is only the 11th largest trading partner of the UK with around £48 billion of trade in goods and services both ways between the two countries.
And this is obviously meant to
be one of the handful of biggest.
I was going to say, and this is meant to step this up. So I just wonder, is it a concern then that it's still not been agreed? And it certainly seems, certainly in the Indian press, that there's a lot of concerns on their side and that they might even want to unwind some of those things that were agreed, particularly things around tariffs on whiskey.
There's no question that with the implementation of this free trade agreement, the bilateral trade, in my view, will go up from £48 billion and double to £100 billion within 5 years. Because what this agreement does is it reduces trade barriers, it improves market access. And the fact that Peter Kyle, our business secretary, is there today meeting with India's trade and industry minister, Piyush Goyal, the fact that Yvette Cooper is going to be there in a couple of days' time to meet with her counterpart, Minister Jayashankar, the India's foreign minister, this will help to implement this FTA.
I was going to say, you think that we'll iron those out? Because, I mean, there are concerns about things that seem pretty intractable about steel quotas, for example, obviously complicated even more now by the fact the government owns a steel company.
And this is the point. Whether it's steel or there are any sticking points, these need to be resolved because the benefits are too big. And at a time like this, where India, for example, is really suffering from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, both countries need this deal. And it's not just trade, by the way. It's investment as well. You've got companies like Tata's investing in the UK, JCB, huge manufacturing and exports from India. And then you've got the Indian population here, the living bridge between our two countries of nearly 2 million people doing really well. So we've got to make the most of this.
Well, we will see if those visits do smooth that out. Lord Karen Billimoria, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. 22 minutes past seven. What does the future hold for toys in a world dominated by technology? That is the big question at the heart of the fifth Toy Story movie, which is about to be released. More than 30 years after the original one, Tom Hanks and Tim Allen are back once again as Woody and Buzz. But as David Sillitoe's been finding out, it's a double act where they only actually meet on the interview circuit.
What, no dog? Let me see you meet. I'm David.
I just need help. Medical help after the dog. Wonder what just happened.
Hey, look, it's a human.
We're in Claridge's, and you're listening to a very bewildered Tim Allen and Joan Cusack.
I walk in there, and it's a dog.
Who've just been interviewed by a puppet.
Joanie Joan, slap me full.
Hi!
Blue Peter's hacker tea dog.
Have you talked to the dog yet?
Huh?
The dog.
What about the dog?
Have you talked to the dog yet?
Welcome to the bizarre world of conveyor belt journalism. The Junket Interview. This one promoting Toy Story 5.
It's good to be back.
Starring, as always, Tom Hanks as Woody, the cowboy, and Tim Allen, the space ranger, Buzz Lightyear.
It's been too long, Woody. Can't hear us.
But taking the lead in this story about female friendship is Joan Cusack as Jessie.
Bonnie still needs us. Our time ain't over yet.
I'm kind of wondering what these two guys are doing, because this is your film, isn't it, Joan?
Oh, yeah.
It is.
So you want us to leave?
Jessie's story. For the girls.
I think Tom and I should take off. This is good. It's literally, we just back her up.
Hi there, I'm Lilypad. Let's play.
And the villain? It's technology and how it's affecting both toys and day-to-day human interaction.
Bonnie, screen time's over now.
Okay.
That disinterest of somebody looking down and they, what?
My youngest, we've had this conversation. I had a little argument. We do a dad-daughter movie things, and she's in a movie theater, like this. And I just caught her. I go,
by the way, that's a thing.
I know.
Yeah.
I put the phone down. They're so used to 7-second movies on Instagram that she actually looked at a motion picture and she goes, I get it. He's going to be the villain, and they're going to do this.
Wow.
And I said, from now on, if we go to movie theaters, we watch the movie, and then you can be ouch about it afterwards.
Hello?
Oh, yeah.
And for Tom and Tim, it's a reprise of one of the movie world's most successful double acts.
My ship has crash-landed here by mistake.
Yes, it is a mistake, because you see, the bed here is my spot.
I need to repair my turbo.
And hours alone, doing the voiceovers.
We don't record together. We have never recorded together.
You have never been in the same recording booth
together. Here's the thing that we are at the cutting edge of all technology as far as movie making, and they still have not figured out a way in order for us to be in the studio at the same time, feeding off each other's energy.
Toy Story 1 has a very rare 100% rating on the Rotten Tomatoes review aggregator. So too does Toy Story 2. Even Toy Story 4 is at a remarkable 97%. And these days, that success means when Toy Story calls, Tom says yes.
I haven't really read the full-through script after Toy Story 2.
Right.
Because I just said, I trust you guys implicitly. You're not, what am I going to do, give notes on what I think? No, it's not going to happen.
Can I play you something? This is from 1995.
Oh, dears.
All of which on this fifth outing led me to think, I want to remind Tim Allen of something he once said.
And this is from the Junket Interview from 1995.
Okay.
I've always loved animated films, and I've always wondered how the voices get done, and now that I know how they're done, I will never, ever do one of these again.
David Sillitoe reporting. 26 minutes past seven, sport time. Here in the studio is Jonathan.
feeding off your energy. I like it. How high can I get? Good morning again. Yes, women's tennis was very much centre stage at the French Open last night. World number one Aryna Sabalenka beat Naomi Osaka 7-5, 6-3 in the first women's singles match in prime-time evening slot at Roland Garros in 3 years. Sabalenka through to the quarterfinals and still on course to win her first title in Paris. Meanwhile, if you've not yet got a ticket for the tournament at Queen's later this month, move fast, especially if you're a fan of Serena Williams, because she confirmed yesterday that her much-anticipated comeback is definitely on, and it will be in the doubles at Queen's, and we'll have more on that in an hour. But what happens if your body won't let you return to competitive tennis like Serena? That was the cruel reality for Britain's 2015 Davis Cup winner, Carl Edmund, who was ranked 14 at the world at his peak. He was forced to quit playing last summer at the age of just 30, but he's now back in the game as an official, and he's been telling me about his new role as assistant tournament director at the Nottingham Open, which starts later this month.
I basically felt like I wanted to stay in sport, but more the business side of sport. I sort of reached out to LTA / the LTA were always keeping in contact and wanted and made sure that I knew that if there was any way they could help, that they were there. So I reached out to them and said I was interested in sort of the tournament directing side. Amy Hutchinson, who's obviously the tournament director at the Nottingham Open, reached out and said, I'd love to have you work with us and I could learn from her because she's been doing it a long time. Pretty much in January, I was introduced and working with a team.
When you're playing, it's all about the focus of winning matches and getting things right on the court. Here it is off the court. The adrenaline rush, I can't believe it's the same. Is it exciting for you? Is it interesting?
When you move forward from something, you find other things that interest you and you get excited and interested and intrigued about something else. And that's what I found myself doing. Maybe, you don't get the same buzz, but when you're interested and you dedicate yourself to something and you apply yourself, that's where you sort of get another bit of interest in your life. And that's, for me, where the business side is. And I've been trying to speak to as many people as I can about it. That's one of the benefits from having the career that I've had, is being in front of some very successful people and learning from them.
You've got this time to think because you announced your retirement last year. What was that moment like? How difficult was it? How are you coming to terms with the fact that, you know, your playing career is done, whatever the future may hold us off the court?
When I was having the surgeries and doing all the rehab, there were lots of emotions, from feeling sorry to yourself, getting angry, frustrated. It was just kind of reality kicking in.
So reassurance for Jack Draper and Emma Raducanu, what would you say as they go through their bumpy patch with injuries? Because it's tough, isn't it?
It is tough, but the good thing is that they do have time on their sides. They still are young. The best thing you have to do is surround yourself with people that you feel you can trust, because as you spend more time off court, the results aren't coming. You find yourself becoming more and more closed, as in the people around you that you trust, you really have to open up to and use them to help you. And that was a big thing for me. People then understood my frame of mind and actually where I was in that moment, rather than pretending it was all good. But you were finding it harder that period, because then they can help you get through the other side and experience those highs again.
Carl Edmund, looking for a new life as assistant tournament director at the Nottingham Open.
Jonathan, thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
Gareth.
Simple question, really. Do you think you're up to this?
A brand new drama starring Joseph Fiennes and Jodie Whittaker.
Everyone thinks that footballers are overconfident, arrogant. They're afraid.
Based on the award-winning play.
Keep believing. Keep going right up until the final whistle. A New England that comes from behind, that fights.
Dear England.
Are England's young lions ready for the game of their lives?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Coming up in a few minutes' time, we will talk to the business owner who says that he went into administration while waiting for the government to make up its mind on defence spending.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna Foster, Justin Webb. The time is 29 minutes to 8. Charles Carroll has the news.
The Russian military says it's carried out what it called a massive strike on Ukraine, targeting cities with drones and ballistic missiles. Ukrainian officials said at least 10 people have been killed and dozens more injured. Ukraine's Air Force says that it intercepted 40 missiles and 602 drones, and that Kyiv was the primary target of the attack. Clashes have continued in southern Lebanon despite President Trump claiming that Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to halt attacks. Lebanon said Hezbollah had accepted a US-backed proposal that would see it stop firing on Israel in exchange for planned Israeli strikes on southern Beirut being called off. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed an agreement had been discussed, but warned that strikes on Beirut would go ahead if Hezbollah attacks persisted. Police have released body cam footage showing officers handcuffing an 18-year-old student who'd been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed that he'd been racially abused. Henry Novak was attacked in Southampton after a night out in December last year. In the footage, he can be heard repeatedly telling officers, "I've been stabbed and I can't breathe." His killer, Vikram Digwa, has been sentenced to life imprisonment and ordered to serve a minimum of 21 years. More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP chief executive Peter Murrell are expected to be outlined in court today. Following his guilty plea to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party, prosecutors are due to set out an agreed narrative of the offences at the High Court in Edinburgh. Nicola Sturgeon, who's estranged from Murrell, says he deceived and betrayed her when he used party funds to buy luxury goods, including watches, cars and a motorhome. And new research suggests that around a third of the British public now think a university degree is no longer worthwhile, with that figure rising dramatically over the past 20 years. An inquiry by MPs into the student loan system in England begins today amid concern about high debt levels. The government says the current finance system protects lower earning graduates.
Thank you, Charles. It's 27 minutes to eight. It was exactly a year ago that the government published its Strategic Defence Review. It was an insight into the threats facing the UK and the wider world and what we'll do to try to counter and protect against them. With conflict and unrest a global problem right now, everyone agreed that that roadmap was a vital one, but it remains technically incomplete because part two, if you like, how this will be paid for, still hasn't been released, despite repeated promises and much pushing for the detail. So when might we actually see the defence investment plan and what effect is that delay having? Well, Robin Southwall is chairman of Aralis, which went into administration earlier this year. And Fred Thomas is the Labour MP for Plymouth Moorview, who sits on the Defence Select Committee. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Robin, first of all, tell us a little bit more about your company and about what you offer and why you've gone into administration.
Yeah, sure. Good morning. We were the poster child, effectively, for the government's defence industry strategy, in as much as we were seeking to generate 4,000 new jobs, £500 million of inward investment, no exact expenditure by the government until the AI system came into service. And we also had a very clear, coherent export strategy. So every single cardinal point of the government's defence industry strategy was ticked green by Aralis, but still we were failed to gain any real momentum and we were unable to develop that because of the delays and the inability of the government to put into practice it's what I believe was an excellent strategy.
So you're saying the whole reason you've gone into administration is the length of time that it has taken the government to publish this?
I wouldn't say the whole reason. In industry, there's always a number of elements. We had financial backing from the Middle East, which of course became difficult given the consequences of the geopolitical situation. And of course, we had to ensure that we had to keep our workforce current and engaged. However, the fundamentals are, as I say, that if you're trying to sell defence equipment into the UK, you only have one customer, and that customer needs to be able, willing and capable to actually fund you.
Fred Thomas, are you frustrated at this delay?
Well, yeah. I mean, firstly, it's really disappointing to hear about Aralis going to administration, and must be brutal for all the people who've been working on that project and staff who are losing their jobs. I think bigger picture, nationally, clearly we have felt some pain across the defence sector, but also within the armed forces, with the delay of the defence investment plan. I am hopeful that we'll now see that in the coming weeks. The defence secretary announced in the chamber yesterday that we can expect to see that published before the NATO summit in Turkey, which is on the 8th of July. So we're looking at a matter of weeks now, but certainly the delay in publishing it has harmed our industry's ability to know what to do, what to invest in, and of course to draw down payment, because otherwise people are putting up private capital just to keep paychecks rolling.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, John Healey said yesterday, and a government spokesperson has said, we're working to finalise the plan. It will be published as soon as possible. John Healey said that the Prime Minister is determined to publish it before the NATO summit. It's not quite the same as saying he will publish it, because the problem here is this has been promised time and time again since August of last year. And that's part of the problem. Instead of saying this will take us a year, it keeps being promised and then taken away again.
Well, we've got to be honest with the British public, I think, in as much as I don't believe the government has to be very clear that we really haven't got an awful lot of money. And if you look at the priorities that the government have in defence and expenditure, I mean, you know, we're at the moment trying to fight wars based on rhetoric, aren't we? And the projection of force in this day and age can only be successful arm of diplomacy if it's credible and sustainable. And the MOD, government, treasury and the defence industry plan has to actually close that box off, because I don't think any of us are clear at the moment.
Yeah, I'm Fred Thomas. Robin Southwell is not the only person saying that. There's been criticism from throughout the defence industry, as we were saying, that this was never billed as having, that it would take a year. Why do you think it's been so repeatedly delayed?
And I think it's a question of prioritisation. So firstly, the government, so number 10 and the Treasury, need to decide exactly how much money defence have to try and fund the strategic defence review that came out a year ago. Then within defence, with that funding envelope, prioritisation decisions need to be made. And that is brutally difficult.
It is, but my point was that they said they could do that by August of last year. They didn't say at the time that it would take as long as this, did they?
Yeah, to be clear, I agree with you, and I absolutely share the frustration that it's taken this long. I think it does speak to a government who are too slow to make decisions, too keen to kind of consider all options, and actually a paralysis then emerges, which harms our ability to carry out our job in terms of defence. I think that it's important for the country to understand the level of threat we are under. One of the key recommendations from the Strategic Defence Review was a national conversation around threat. Until people understand that, then some of the decisions around how do we fund defence will be very difficult to sell to MPs across the House and to the wider public. I'm very excited the government outside of defence, but the security minister announced a few weeks ago, he's announced a review of how we'd measure our national threat level, which previously has always just been terrorism. And he's reviewing that, so that may change. And my hope is that will include an assessment of state-based threat, because ultimately, as Robin alluded to, there is only so much money and very difficult decisions need to be made.
Yes, but
we do need to fund our forces.
Are you, Fred Thomas, that frustration that you expressed there with the way the government have handled this, have you fed that back directly yourself to Downing Street?
Yes, of course I have. And I sit on the Defence Committee, and we as a Defence Committee have made multiple private and public statements and encouragements to government to speed up with this. It's been widely understood how this is damaging our defence industry. I think what has been less understood is how it's damaging our actual armed forces and our capability, because we have to start rearming and modernising our forces, which there have been efforts to do, but not at the scale and the pace that is required. And you just reported now on your news bulletin that Russia fired 602 drones last night. Well, that's what modern warfare looks like. And we know for years now, since the full-scale invasion in 2022 in Ukraine, that as many as 80%, sometimes reported as 90% of battlefield casualties on either side in the Ukraine-Russia war are caused by drones, not by people firing rifles or artillery. And there is a huge question mark of whether Britain's forces could currently do that. Mm. What we need is a defence investment plan to show a clear route to rearming and modernising our forces and our capability. Because once we've bought those items, hopefully, we then need to train, reassess our doctrine,
it's something
our tactics.
That always takes a period of time, and we've seen that in conflicts past as well, haven't we? Fred Thomas, the Labour MP for Plymouth Moorview, and Robin Southwell, the chairman of Aralis. Thank you both.
19 minutes to 8 is the time. John McFall lost a leg at the age of 19. It has not held him back. He won bronze in sprinting at the 2008 Beijing Paralympics. He's worked as an orthopaedic surgeon. He can fly a plane as well. And now an agreement has been signed by the UK government that could see him go into space. John McFall is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell us about the agreement.
Yeah, so the agreement's between the UK government and VAST, which is a US commercial space industry. And it is this particular agreement brings me one step closer to hopefully realizing a world first, which is a professional astronaut in space who happens to have a physical disability living and working as a professional astronaut. But it also actually is slightly wider than this. The agreement has wider implications for the space sector and the space industry in the UK. VAST are looking to essentially provide a low Earth orbit platform to replace the International Space Station in the years to come. The ISS isn't going to be there for forever. And in delivering, in delivering that, the UK have got an opportunity to provide a lot of the technology and hardware and services to deliver this. So, yeah, really, really exciting.
And you say you would be someone who happens to have a physical disability. To what extent, though, would that be an important part potentially of the flight, the idea of how you cope with it in space, but also whether the fact of being in space could be useful when it comes to working out more about your own body and it potentially helping people in the future?
Yeah, exactly, Justin. The reality is we don't know what it is like for someone with a disability. I'm a lower limb amputee. What it's going to be like for someone with a disability like mine living and working in space. Is missing a leg going to be a hindrance? Is having wearing a prosthesis going to be of benefit? What happens to the physiology of someone with a limb missing in space? Because I have slightly less lower body volume to start with, i.e. missing a leg, will there be less fluid shift up towards my trunk and my head? And we know that fluid shift in living and working in microgravity can cause problems with the eyes. So might I be, you know, less susceptible to those conditions? So there is an awful lot to learn.
But just to be clear, though, I mean, those are interesting questions, but the basic fact that you are medically fit to go has already been sorted out. You are, aren't you?
Yeah, I've met all the medical requirements to fly to space and technically met the operational requirements. And it's just a question of now realizing that opportunity, getting an opportunity to fly in space and demonstrate actually that it is feasible and also, you know, learn an awful lot of when doing it.
Is there a timeline?
Well, no earlier than summer of 2027 we're looking at. So maybe from mid-27 onwards.
Which is quite soon, actually. I mean, presumably there's a timeline soon, anyway, yeah. For you, because you're not getting any younger. None of us are. But I mean, there is a huge interest, isn't there, at the moment, and a huge involvement. We've been talking to people on the program recently about the amount of money now that's going into not just NASA, actually, but private companies as well. So the possibility is there probably now much more than it would have been, I don't know, 5 years or so ago.
Yeah, absolutely. The world of human space exploration is changing. The access to space is changing. And the way in which we understand space and are able to use it is also, our understanding of that is growing. And, you know, this concept, Justin, of space for Earth is really important. What we do in space often has tremendous benefits for us living here on Earth. And yeah, I'm very excited to be a part of that.
Okay, well, we hope you get there. John McFall, thanks very much for talking to us.
It's 7:45 now. In a few moments' time, we'll speak to three young people who've got their whole lives and careers ahead of them about whether they think that going to university is actually worth the time and the money. But before that, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Professor Tina Beatty, writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. I recently had to write a painful letter to someone I love. I sent it to a friend for advice and she ran it through ChatGPT. It came back polished for sensitivity and kindness. I couldn't fault it, So why did I feel sick when I read it? I think it's because the AI version lacked a soul, my soul. The letter was too perfect because it had been dehumanized. The struggle and sorrow were gone, but so was the love. Pope Leo launched his first encyclical last week, titled Magnifica Humanitas, Magnificent Humanity. It asks how we might strive together to preserve our human magnificence in the face of the threat posed by AI to the very meaning of what it is to be human. It calls us to connection and cooperation, rather than the disconnection and competition fueled by AI. For me, it's an invitation to rediscover the quotidian beauty and vulnerability of embodied, dependent life. The encyclical speaks of illusory forms of salvation offered by technology. These include transhumanist and posthumanist ideologies that seek to transcend the human condition by eliminating all that is weak, suffering, and finite. Over and against these fantasies of perfection, Pope Leo invites us to experience our capacity for transcendence, not above and beyond, but in and through our bodily lives, as an adventure that is, he says, both tragic and splendid. We must relieve suffering where we can, but sorrow, finitude, and struggle are woven into the human condition. They can be sources of wisdom, bringing us closer to one another and to God. The Pope is no Luddite. Magnifica Humanitas is as much about the good that AI can do as about the dangers it poses, so long as it's used to serve and not to master our humanity. We must, says the Pope, disarm AI from the mentality of armed conflict fueled by powerful algorithms. The encyclical asks us to use AI in ways that resist its dehumanizing effects. Through it all runs a persistent reminder that the power of love is greater than the love of power, and that our task, as J.R. Tolkien wrote, is not to master all the tides of the world, but to do what we can for the salvation of the years in which we live.
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Tina Beattie, writer and Catholic theologian. It's 12 minutes to 8.
Is it worth going to university? The British Social Attitudes Survey out today suggests that a third of people agree with the notion that university is not worth the time and the money, as they put it, and only 14% thought that back in 2005. It is, of course, a very live debate. It's the cost of the loans, it's the fact of graduate unemployment. It's a sense as well that some universities aren't really providing much for the money that they take. Let us talk to three young people who are making different decisions about universities and non-university world. Jack and Harry are on the line. Jack, 21, and doing a degree. Harry is doing a degree apprenticeship at the age of 18. And Caitlin also joins us, who's not going to university at all. Morning to you all.
Good morning.
Caitlin, can I kick off with you? Why not? Why aren't you going?
Well, everyone always asks you, like, what you're going to do when you leave school, what you're going to do when you leave college. And my answer was always, well, I don't know. And then it got to university and it was like, well, what do you want to do? And it was like, well, I don't know. So I don't know what I want to do after college. So I don't personally see the point in going if that I don't know what I want to do right now.
Did you go to open days? Are your friends going?
All my friends are going to university. They know what they want to do when they're finished, but I went to some of the open days and it just wasn't for me.
Did you feel a pressure to go? A kind of social pressure or pressure from the school, pressure from, I don't know, your parents? Did you feel that you were sort of bucking the trend not to go?
Yeah, I guess so, because all my friends are like, oh, like, we need to apply for university, and all the teachers were like, we need to get UCAS done. And I was like, well, I don't really want to go. And they were like, yeah, but you need to apply anyway. I was like, no, don't.
Jack, you took a different decision. You decided to go, which I'm assuming you don't regret.
No, I've loved every minute of it so far. I'm only in first year, but I think it's just the best decision I could have made.
And the best decision because you see it leading to something, or because the experience itself is valuable to you?
Both. I want to be a physiotherapist after I graduate. So kind of the only way that you can get through it is through university. There are degree apprenticeships, but they're much more competitive.
Right. So for you, it actually leads to something. You can see that having the degree it is going to put you in a better position work-wise than it would have been otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah. Harry, you've taken an interesting decision because the degree apprenticeship, which of course is quite a common thing now, but it's a sort of, well, it's a bit of both, isn't it? Why did you go down that route?
Yeah, so I decided to degree apprenticeship just because you can earn whilst you learn, as well as you don't get the university debt, which saves a good amount of money at the end as well. And it gives you the work experience, which employers look for, plus the degree at the end, which they also look for. So it's a pretty good choice.
Is there any disadvantage to it? Because, of course, you've got the work side of it as well and the non-academic side, and you've got to turn up and do it. Or is that actually an advantage, would you say?
I would say it's a massive advantage because you're earning. But the only disadvantage I see is just trying to manage work with your schoolwork, which can be a bit tricky, but if you're able to stay focused, I think it's definitely the best bet.
Jack, do you have a sense that possibly your younger brother is doing the right thing in that he's actually got, I mean, particularly on the money side of it, I suppose, before you think about anything else, I mean, he's not going to have the debts that you might have?
Oh, yeah, I think he's in a much better position for the long term with no debts. So I am kind of jealous about that, but there's not many routes for physiotherapy within the degree apprenticeship route. So I kind of had to take the university.
You had to do what you do. And Caitlin, how important was the money side of it for you? Because you are going to go into the world of work and you're going to go into the world of work without a student debt. Did that figure at all in the decision that you made?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of money to go to university, especially when you'd be paying it off for years and years afterwards. And especially if I didn't know what I was going to do, there was no point racking up the debt just to go to university for the sake of going.
Right, but if you'd known what you wanted to do, would it have put you off, or would you have just thought, well, I've just got to live with it?
I think I'd have just live with it. If I knew exactly what I wanted to do and I had to go to university to do that, and was quite happy to pay the debt, like have the debt to go.
Do you worry, Caitlin, that you're missing out socially? I mean, there's not necessarily a reason to incur that debt, but a lot of people when they go to university, and we'll talk to Jack and Harry in a second about it, a lot of people go to university and have a really good time and make friends that they have for the rest of their lives. Do you feel that you might miss out on that?
Yeah, a little bit. All my friends are going to, most of them are going to the same university, so they're all in like the same housing or like are planning on going like out together and doing stuff. And it is like a shame, but it's like I've got work lined up. I'm going to be meeting more different people as well.
Well, that's
so
true,
really,
isn't it?
Now in that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, you'll certainly meet people at work. I suppose it's the range of people, Jack. Do you find that you are meeting people, hand on heart, are you meeting people at university and kind of being enriched by it in a way that you wouldn't have done in other circumstances and at home?
Yeah, I mean, I come from a very small village, so it's nice to be at a university where you get a lot of people from different cultures, different backgrounds, and, you know, everyone has something in common eventually, so it's nice just to be able to meet people.
Do you think it changes you as a person?
Significantly, yeah. You need to be able to adapt to who you're speaking to, and it also is nice to, you know, be able to hear people's stories.
Yeah, and that, of course, is traditionally a reason to go to university, isn't it, Harry? That kind of sense that you are brought out of yourself and you're mixing with people who are doing interesting things. And I suppose things that haven't occurred to you might occur to you, both, I don't know, intellectually in the degree that you're doing, but also just more widely as well, socially. Harry.
Oh, sorry, apologies.
Sorry,
yes,
that was
no,
for
I
you,
agree.
Yeah. No, yeah, my no, apologies, I didn't make it clear enough. But I'm just wondering what you think about whether you've been kind of brought out of yourself by the experience.
Absolutely, massively. So I've, just like Jack, moved from a small town up to London. So massive, massive change for me. And I've got relatives up in London, but no real friends up there. So with work, I'm the youngest in my whole workplace. So it is completely just a whole new environment. But I quite, I deal quite well in those situations, so I've managed to work my way around it, and I enjoy it.
Do you, Caitlin, because the other thing, of course, we're talking to you, you're all three of you young, you're all three of you of kind of university age or non-university age, Caitlin, if you're going into work, but you could go back to it in later life, couldn't you? I mean, if you suddenly decide that there is something, and that's we tend to talk, don't we, possibly too much about university as if it's only a thing for young people, and it isn't necessarily.
Yeah, quite a lot of people have told me that they went to university like in their 20s and did their degree then, and it really helped like later on.
What did they say about the experience of doing it later on?
Said it was just the same, like they enjoyed it.
Do you have a sense, Jack, finally, of, I don't know, the value of it? It's a really difficult thing to do, isn't it? When you look at the debt on the one hand, or possibly you don't look at it, and then you look at the experience, the broad experience, on the other, what do you reckon?
I definitely think it's worth it. It's just, you can't get a culture and an environment which you won't get in any other places.
Okay, well, look, we're going to be talking to a university vice-chancellor at 8:30 or after 8:30, but it's really good to talk to the three of you. Jack, Harry, Caitlin, all the best in whatever you do next.
Tomorrow, Radio 4 continues to ask questions about AI.
The Artificial Human on Radio 4 returns for a new series to demystify the world of artificial intelligence.
I'm Alex Krotowski.
And I'm Kevin Fong. Join us as we look beyond the hype to answer the questions that AI can't.
With the World Cup this summer, should we replace football managers with AI?
Does anyone need to learn to program if AI can write all the software itself?
And if AI is transforming warfare, will humans still need to be on the front line?
The new series of The Artificial Human, Wednesday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Weather time, here's Hella Willits.
Justin, thank you very much. And it's been all change with the weather, hasn't it, in the past couple of days? And at last, some welcome rain, more than just a drop as well. In some places, we've seen in excess of 30 millimetres. So that's some southern counties of England. Let's start with England and Wales, because in the east, we still have the overnight rain hanging on. So more rain yet to come, particularly East Anglia and the southeast. Heavy showers are following behind through the home counties around the M25 at the moment, and also more coming into the western side of England and Wales. So it's a day of sunny spells and scattered heavy showers. And those showers are likely to be hefty, some intense downpours with gusty winds and accompanying hail, even some thunder and lightning. We've seen that already. And temperatures, well, obviously down on what they were last week, but around average for June, 15 to 20, perhaps 21 in the far southeast. For Northern Ireland, we've also had quite murky weather around the Irish Sea coast this morning. Some fog around to accompany the slow-moving showery rain here. And that's really going to be the name of the game today, because there's very little wind across Northern Ireland, parts of Scotland, to move the showers on, whilst across England and Wales we do have a breeze. So hefty showers for Northern Ireland, slow-moving, hail and thunder particularly this morning, temperatures up to about 15. And for Scotland, it is sunny spells and scattered showers across southern and western areas. But in the north and the east, the remnants of the overnight rain are going to hang around here across Highland, Grampian, into the Northern Isles as well, limiting the temperature to 14 or 15.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 2nd of June. The headlines this morning: the UN Weather Organization is warning of what's being called a Godzilla El Nino later this year, affecting the climate around the world. We'll be examining the consequences.
It's a scary thought, because this one, they're now giving it the ear tag of Super El Nino.
This kind of situation generally disrupt the entire supply chain.
The Russian military has carried out what it called a massive strike across Ukraine. At least 11 people have been killed. And MPs are to start examining the student loan system in England, as research suggests fewer people think a degree is worth the money.
Also on the programme, is the Prime Minister really lacking verve and buckling under pressure? We'll ask one of his ministers. Police body cam footage has been released that shows officers speaking to the man who murdered a student while his victim lay dying in handcuffs. We'll discuss the police response to that. And a new play revisits the life of pioneering naturalist Eleanor Glanville, whose obsession with butterflies led a court to declare her deprived of her senses. Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
A report which has just been published by the United Nations Climate and Weather Body, the World Meteorological Organization, is warning that one of the strongest El Niños on record may be developing in the Pacific Ocean. It's a natural weather phenomenon which results in hotter and drier weather than usual in some places and significantly wetter conditions in others. This one's already being described by some scientists as a Godzilla El Niño. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
El Niño is one of the most powerful forces shaping the planet's weather, a warming of the tropical Pacific that sends a pulse of ocean heat into the atmosphere, pushing up global temperatures and potentially disrupting the patterns of heat, rainfall and storms around the world. El Niño's impacts vary, but it often raises the risk of drought and wildfires in the Amazon, Australia and Southeast Asia, while bringing heavier rain and potential floods to parts of the Americas. And remember, it comes as climate change has already made the planet significantly warmer. It means El Niño will, says UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, pour fuel on the fire of a warming world. Impacts will hit even harder, travel even further, and cross borders with devastating speed, he says.
Russia has carried out a large wave of attacks across Ukraine, using more than 650 drones and more than 70 ballistic missiles. Officials in the capital, Kyiv, say 4 people have been killed there and more than 50 injured, including several children. Local authorities in the eastern city of Dnipro say that another 6 people have died in attacks there. Moscow had warned last week that it would launch systematic strikes on Ukraine. From Kyiv, Vitaly Shevchenko sent this report.
The attacks began in the early hours of the morning, with Russia sending a flurry of missiles and drones across Ukraine. In central Kyiv, we felt a building shake as a quick succession of missiles struck a neighbourhood nearby. Ukraine's air defence systems rang out in the dark. Kyiv's mayor says that scores of people have been injured and several killed. As the sun rises, the full extent of the damage is being revealed. In the capital, at least 2 residential buildings and a hospital were damaged. Russia had warned last week it would hit targets in Kyiv and urged foreigners to leave the city.
The Ukrainian MP Alexei Gorodchenko, who's in Kyiv, has told this programme that the last few hours have been extremely difficult.
That was an awful night. There was a huge Russian missile and drone attack, probably one of the biggest during the war, and if to speak about using hypersonic missiles, it's the largest attack. A lot of destruction, and again, a lot of civilian infrastructure. It was hit and civilian areas damaged. Russian terror continues.
Clashes have continued in southern Lebanon, despite President Trump claiming that Israel and Hezbollah had agreed to halt attacks. Lebanon said Hezbollah had accepted a US-backed proposal that would see it stop firing on Israel in exchange for planned Israeli strikes on southern Beirut being called off. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed an agreement had been discussed, but warned that strikes on Beirut would go ahead if Hezbollah attacks persisted. From Beirut, Lina Sinjab reports.
This is the first time an American president has spoken to Hezbollah, even through a mediator. The group is designated as a terror group. But the round of talks President Trump said he held yesterday has saved the capital, Beirut, an imminent strike. Hezbollah agreed to stop attacking northern Israel, and the latter would not attack the capital, Beirut. But the south of the country is still out of the equation. At the weekend, there were talks on a gradual comprehensive ceasefire, which Iran is pushing for, to be part of US-Iran deal. But Israel has not committed to that. They have boots on the ground, and they have occupied big swathes of land, including the strategic 900-year-old Beaufort Castle.
Police have released body cam footage of the moment officers handcuffed a student who had been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed to have been racially abused by him. Henry Novak, who was 18, was attacked in Southampton after a night out in December last year. His killer, Vikram Digwa, has been told that he will serve at least 21 years for his murder. You may find the sound of the video distressing. Aruna Iyengar reports.
All right,
He's jumped over these fences and stuff like
that. In the body cam footage, which was played in court, Henry Novak, a student at Southampton University, was heard telling police that he'd been stabbed. His plea was ignored. Officers arrested him and put him in handcuffs.
What's happened to you, right? You've been stabbed? Whereabouts? I don't think you have, mate.
The last sound was of Mr. Novak being handcuffed. As this was happening, his attacker, Vikram Digwa, tried to frame himself as a victim, falsely claiming that he'd been racially attacked. Donna Jones, the Hampshire Police and Crime Commissioner, said it was devastating that officers did not believe Henry, adding that the case raised serious concerns about police impartiality, fairness and judgment.
More details of the crimes committed by the former SNP Chief Executive Peter Murrell are expected to be outlined at the High Court in Edinburgh today. Murrell pleaded guilty last week to embezzling more than £400,000 from the party. Nicola Sturgeon, who's estranged from Murrell, says that he deceived and betrayed her when he used party funds to buy luxury goods, including watches, cars and a motorhome. South West Water is due to be sentenced after admitting supplying water unfit for human consumption to customers in Devon. It was linked to an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis in May 2024, with 143 confirmed cases and four people taken to hospital. The company could now face a multi-million pound fine, as our South West England correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
On May the 14th, 2024, South West Water told residents in the Hillhead area of Brixham that their tap water was safe to drink, despite confirmed cases of cryptosporidiosis. The illness is caused by a tiny parasite, which triggers stomach problems and diarrhoea. The following day, there was a U-turn. Around 17,000 households were told they had to boil their water. The company said overnight testing had found traces of the parasite in the supply.
Police in Mexico City have fired tear gas as they clashed with teachers who are striking over pay and pension reforms. Members of one of the country's largest teaching unions are threatening to disrupt the opening day of the Men's Football World Cup in 10 days' time. New research suggests that around a third of the British public now think a university degree is no longer worthwhile, with the figure increasing dramatically over the past 20 years. An inquiry by MPs into the student loan system in England begins today amid concern about high debt levels. The government says the current finance system protects lower-earning graduates, while Universities UK says it's doing more to help students prepare for jobs. Here's our education editor, Bronwyn Jeffries.
Figures from the British Social Attitudes Survey give a 20-year perspective on how public faith in the value of a university degree has declined as the costs and number of graduates have risen. The research suggests that last year, 34% of people in the UK thought a degree wasn't worth the time or money. In 2005, the figure was 14%. MPs on the Treasury Committee will today begin hearing evidence as part of their investigation into student loans in England, following growing pressure from graduates over the repayment threshold and the interest rate, in a sign of the strength of feeling. More than 50,000 written submissions have already been made.
The former British Paralympic sprinter John McFaul could become the first disabled astronaut to travel to the International Space Station. The UK Space Agency is signing a memorandum of understanding with the private space company VAST, which could see him reach the ISS as soon as July next year. John McFaul, who had a leg amputated above the knee, told this programme he thinks a lot could be learned by seeing how someone with a physical disability could live and work in orbit.
I've met all the medical requirements to fly to space and technically met the operational requirements. The world of human space exploration is changing. The access to space is changing. And the way in which we understand space and are able to use it is also, our understanding of that is growing.
The potential astronaut, John McFaul.
Thank you, Charles. It's 10 minutes past 8.
Is enough being done to prepare for what scientists around the globe are predicting will be a super El Niño? That is a weather pattern. It happens every few years, not on a fixed time scale, but when it occurs at scale, it has a huge effect on the global climate. And it's something that we will see and suffer from. It leads to events like record-breaking hot temperatures, forest fires and flooding. In fact, the World Meteorological Organization is predicting that this year's could be the strongest El Niño on record. Well, let's speak to Celeste Saulo, who's Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. Good morning.
Good morning. My pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Just to explain, it's a phenomenon that some people may well have heard of, but not quite understand the full implications of. What do scientists think will happen later this year?
Okay, well, what we are noticing already is that as of mid-May 2026, the sea surface temperature anomalies are increasing across the central eastern equatorial Pacific. So having a warm area over that part of the ocean drives a series of circulation patterns across the world. And so something that starts in the Pacific Ocean in the reality ends up creating other implications and other impacts across the whole world, be it in Latin America, be it in Southeast Asia or Africa. I would say a little bit less in Europe.
Okay, but as you were saying, it's something that's experienced very widely, and some of the impacts that we describe there, it's not just about bad weather, it's what that actually does to us as humans.
Exactly. I think that we need to take a lot of attention into, for example, warming and higher temperatures. As you may remember, in the previous El Niño, we noticed that as a result, 2024 was the warmest year on record. And that average temperature that was highest in 2024 implies that heat waves, for example, can be stronger and more damaging. And as you also mentioned, in areas where we will see droughts, wildfires can be very dangerous. So it's about extreme weather, it's about extreme events, and how we need to prepare for those.
Is it caused by human behavior? And in fact, can human behavior do anything to change the pattern of what is about to happen?
Well, in this particular case, I want to be very clear. El Niño is part of a natural climate variability. So in this pattern, we see something that has been happening for several years now, and this is a cyclic phenomena. So this is what we call, as scientists, natural variability. But as you mentioned, on top of the natural variability, we know there is a trend towards warming climate. That's why associated with El Niño that warms the system even more, we can expect even higher temperatures and also changes or impact in the precipitation patterns. So it's a combination of natural variability and climate trend what becomes more, challenging for all of us.
So it's the effect of the two things together. Celeste Saulo, thank you, Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. Well, those who have experience of the El Niño effect are already worried about what might be to come in the next few months. Neil Watson is a cattle farmer in Australia.
It's a scary thought because this one they're now giving it the ear tag of super El Niño. So it does make you nervous as to how severe it's going to be. But what El Niño will do, or a dry period, a lot of people downsell their herds, and some people have either destocked totally or reduced at least half their cows. So someone that might have been running, 1,000 breeders might be back to 400 or 500 cows. Those cows have been processed and have gone to the United States as grinding mince for the hamburger industry. So those cattle are gone. They will not be in the numbers for breeders next year. Therefore, there won't be a weaner calf available next year from those cows. So there'll be a shortage in supply.
So agriculture, one of the industries that will be affected. Others will feel that too. And we'll see changes in the natural environment as well. So what will the impact be, you might ask, on us here in the UK? Well, Professor Mars Allen is Head of Atmospheric, Oceanic and Planetary Physics at the University of Oxford. Good morning.
Good morning.
We got a hint there from what Neil had to say about the agricultural industry. And of course, that affects us wherever we are. But what will we see around us, first of all, in terms of weather?
Well, the impact on UK weather is actually, as our colleague from WMO said, pretty subtle. So the main impact is actually through our global food supply system. And, you know, we can expect certain food imports to become more expensive, and that'll be a knock-on impact on inflation as a result. And, of course, this is at a time when fertilizers are under pressure because of what's happening in the Gulf, and the global food system is creaking anyway under the impact of global warming.
Okay, so we won't see things like particularly hot temperatures or flooding, for example.
Well, there is an impact. We tend to see warmer, drier summers and potentially colder winters during El Nino events. But I wouldn't want to say that's a hard and fast prediction, because there's lots of impacts on the different factors impacting UK weather. So we can't say because there's an El Nino happening, we're definitely going to see a certain type of season. The impacts are through our links to other parts of the world.
Okay. And what about, I mean, we talked about things like forest fires, flooding in other areas. And how do they impact industry as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And we were likely to see wetter conditions in the southern and western US. I can remember the first time I went to California was an El Nino year, and it was chucking it. And at a time of year when normally it's completely dry. So there, the impact is very pronounced. And in the northern US, we see conversely much drier conditions. It's because of a diversion of the jet stream that everybody's heard of, a diversion of weather from north to south, meaning that rainfall tends to fall further south than north during an El Nino year. And as a result of that, yes, we'll almost certainly see in Canada and northern US much greater impact on wildfires. And perhaps even more seriously, actually, lest we focus too much on the rich parts of the world, we've seen in El Nino conditions in the past horrendous fires in Indonesia associated with dry conditions there. And they get these persistent fires in the peatlands of Indonesia. Many people don't realize that tropical peatlands are a big feature of our tropics. And when those fires get going, they're impossible to put out. And they have in the past created a horrible sort of smoke haze over the whole of Southeast Asia. So that's actually something. And by the way, incidentally, I work on global warming, also putting a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, which doesn't help us either. Yeah. So it's those big global impacts that we're likely to feel the consequences of.
So if you're sitting and listening to this morning and thinking, well, this sounds terrible, what can I do? Is it beyond my control? Should I be worried? What should I prepare for? What would you say to that person who might rightly be thinking those things?
As I keep emphasizing, the impact on British weather is relatively subtle, but there will be parts of the world that will be adversely affected, and we should be doing more to help those parts of the world. That's one of the things that there's a sort of retreat back from helping other countries these days, and that makes it much harder to deal with these big climate phenomena that impact some parts of the world more than others. And so that's one thing we can be doing is reasserting that need for global interdependence, global help when natural disasters happen, that became sort of common currency in the second half of the 20th century, and we seem to be rather backing off at the moment. So that's something people can do, is to think about our responsibilities for helping other parts of the world when they're affected by natural disasters, because, of course, the time will come when we will be, and we'll need help from others as well. And we're also a relatively affluent country, although it doesn't feel like that these days. It's only right for us to help parts of the world that are badly affected. Can we do anything about this El Nino that's happening? Absolutely not. This is a natural phenomenon. It happens every few years. What is happening, though, is that, of course, El Nino is being, many of the impacts of El Nino are being reinforced by the impacts of climate change. An El Nino year is warmer than the opposite, a La Nina year. But actually, La Nina years these days are actually warmer than El Nino years were only a few decades ago. So that gives you a sense of the scale of the background trend. And that background trend is because of us, because of carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere, because of burning fossil fuels. And that we can do something about.
Professor Miles Allen, thank you. Head of Atmospheric, Oceanic and Planetary Physics at the University of Oxford.
20 past eight is the time the government published the Mandelson communications yesterday and is dealing with the aftermath today of what the I newspaper calls on its front page a rare glimpse into the inner workings and private messages of UK cabinet ministers. Let us talk to one of them. Nick Thomas Symonds is the Cabinet Office Minister and is doing the round this morning. The unlucky person, you could say. Good morning, Mr. Thomas Symonds.
Good morning, Justice. Never unlucky to be interviewed by you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. And you're actually, there's no embarrassment for you, is there? Because your phone was nicked. I mean, it was nicked before any of this stuff and the demand that messages be made available was made, wasn't it?
Stolen, unfortunately, on my wife's birthday last year. Was horrible experience. Actually, I lost significant amounts of data, not just WhatsApps, but personal photographs as well. But just to be clear, Justin, on transparency, when I spoke to what we call the humble address team in government, there would have been some messages between myself and Peter Mandelson. This was my personal phone, I hasten to add, not my government phone, but around congratulations about my appointment, his subsequent appointment. There would have been an exchange when he was campaigning, as I think we've seen in a lot of the messages to be the Chancellor of the University of Oxford. So I've always been someone in favour of transparency. In fact, I was the person in the debate on this matter in February who was brokering the role of the Independent Intelligence and Security Committee. So rest assured, I've been driving forward that transparency.
On the congratulations, I mean, there's lots of it. Lots of congratulations have been published. And in a sense, it doesn't matter. Although, does it suggest that there was a myopia about the fact that he had been very friendly with Jeffrey Epstein, that Epstein had done what you all knew he had done, and that actually, you know, the phrase boys club was used in the Commons, wasn't it, yesterday, that actually, in retrospect, you were all of you way too enthusiastic and way too quick, actually, not to think about the victims?
Well, I would dispute that, because I think that Jeffrey Epstein's victims and the awful suffering that they had under his appalling crimes is something that's been very much at the forefront of my mind.
But you knew that Lord Mandelson had been pally with him.
Look, I had no idea about the depth and the darkness of the relationship between Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein. And I was shocked, absolutely shocked, last September when that came to light and the Prime Minister then sacked him as the ambassador to the United States. But I would also push back on this idea of boys club as well. We've got, for example, the one ambassadorial appointment that I have a lot of interest in, as you would imagine, Justin, is our ambassador to the European Union. We have Caroline Wilson taking over very shortly in that role that I'm very much looking forward to working with.
Yeah. Let's get to the one message, I suppose, that has the most political substance, and it's from Pat McFadden, and it says, every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others? They're asking the wrong questions. And he's talking about Labour backbenchers. Are they asking the wrong questions?
Well, first of all, the very fact you have that message and other, and look, they are embarrassing, Jessica, I'm not hiding from that, but the reason they're in the public domain is because of the government's desire to comply with the humble address. But let me just take the point about Pat McFadden, who I worked with very closely prior to the last reshuffle in the Cabinet Office. And his view has always been about an emphasis not on the benefit side, but an emphasis on giving people opportunities. And that's why you've seen over the last week, I think he was even on the Today programme last week, talking about the work that he is doing to tackle youth unemployment, which is at 729,000. According to Alan Milburn's interim report, could be at over a million by the end of the decade.
I take your point about that, but he is talking about Labour backbenchers. Every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others? They are asking the wrong questions. So my question to you is that right? Are Labour backbenchers, in the view of ministers, asking the wrong questions?
Well, it's not my experience. Obviously, Pat is talking there about meetings he's been in, but it's not my experience. I think what I've found with...
Well, no, hang on a second. I mean, we'd be interested to hear what you've found in a second, but just this is his experience. He's the Work and Pension Secretary. He's in charge of this stuff. If there are going to be significant cuts to welfare, or at least changes to the way in which welfare is increasing in the national budget, then he is going to be intimately involved. And he appears to believe that Labour MPs are not on board for the job.
Well, he's talked about asking the wrong questions, but I don't accept that Labour MPs, all of us together, are not determined to tackle the scourge of youth unemployment, which is the focus. And you've seen it over the last week with Alan Milburn's interim report, but also the measures that Pat is talking about to bring down that number, from whether it's incentives, financial incentives, to employers to employ young people and indeed to take on apprentices, whether it is the hundreds of thousands of work experience places, because we've seen over a number of years a decline in things like Saturday jobs. So that work, we are absolutely united as a parliamentary party behind.
But what about when it comes to taxing wealthier people more and paying the money in benefits? Is that a good thing or a bad thing to do?
Well, I don't accept in any way that it's as simple as you've just suggested.
Well, because that's what Pat McFadden is suggesting Labour MPs believe.
Well, he was talking about people asking, as I understand, asking the wrong question. But that the debate I have had, the discussions I have with Labour MPs, is a joint and shared determination to tackle what I call the bills of economic and social failure, not making sure we don't lose a generation of young people. But at the same time, we talk about the welfare bill. I'm also proud that we have, within the last 6-7 weeks, or a bit further back, in the start of April rather, we have increased the state pension through the triple lock by up to £575 a year. So far from being ashamed by that bill going up, I am proud that we are doing that, looking after pensioners up and down the country.
I want to ask you as well about this shocking footage.
Yes. Yeah.
The footage of this handcuffing of a man, Henry Novak, who turned out to be stabbed and to later die. Nigel Farage has been talking about it this morning, saying it's footage of discrimination. A white boy handcuffed by police officers, more concerned, he says, by accusations of racism than an act of murder. Is he right or wrong?
The footage, the body cam footage, is every parent's nightmare. It is harrowing and it is absolutely shocking. And the conduct of the police, when you look at it at the scene, is shocking. Now, it is right that the Independent Office of Police Conduct now conducts an investigation without fear or favour and draws conclusions on the basis of the evidence. But there are unquestionably serious questions to answer. And I'm sure, just in looking at that, I'm sure your thoughts, my thoughts, the thoughts of all your listeners this morning are with Henry's family and Henry's friends, not only being the victim of a heinous crime, but also the lies of the perpetrator, the lies at the scene, the false accusations of racism. But remember as well, this perpetrator lied and lied and lied and put Henry's family through a whole contested trial.
But I suppose the point that Nigel Farage has made, and to an extent the point that Henry's father made as well, is that there is a culture that is now affecting the police where they are not able to see things straight because, as Nigel Farage puts it this morning, the rights and privileges of white people matter less than those of ethnic minorities.
Look, I accept in this, what has happened here, the heinous events we've seen, the chilling and harrowing footage, there are serious questions to answer. Nobody is disputing that.
Including that question, though. I mean, would you say that it is a legitimate question to ask now?
It must be for the Independent Office of Police Conduct, without fear or favour, to ask all the questions that are necessary to get to the truth of what happened here. But can I just come back on a broader point, Justin, because it is important. Absolutely crucial that we get those answers and people held to account here. But as we are speaking, there will also be police officers up and down the country running towards danger when others are running in the opposite direction. And we shouldn't forget the job that our police, our frontline police officers, are doing day to day, doing an honest job of work as well.
Nick Thomas Simmons, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is 29 minutes past 8 now, and it's time for the sport. Jonathan Ledyard's back.
Morning again. Football's Spygate story continues to serve up new revelations. This time it's the owner of Southampton Football Club making waves. Dragan Salak has told the BBC that he will not sack Tonda Ekka, despite the head coach being found guilty of orchestrating a spying campaign for the club against their championship rivals. The Serbian businessman says that the German still has his full support.
I'm looking at him as a young man, 32 years old, extremely talented manager. And we have to look into the future. I think he deserves the second chance. I truly hope that he will learn from this experience and he will achieve an incredible career in his life.
He also admits that the FA could yet ban Eckhart, but says he feels that Southampton have already been punished disproportionately. More of the interview on BBC Sport Online. So, Serena Williams is making her much-anticipated return to tennis. She confirmed the news yesterday, joined the French Open, and for tennis fans in Britain, it's even more exciting because her comeback is happening at Queen's Club in West London with a tournament starting next week. She's playing doubles with the Canadian teenager Victoria Mboko, but is this just a warm-up for a singles return, I wonder? Let's talk to Annabelle Croft. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how excited are you? How exciting is it for tennis that one of sport's greatest performers is coming back after 4 years of, and let's remember her words, evolving away from tennis?
Well, it is certainly very, very big news. And I must admit, it's not what I expected. I'm wondering, as you've just asked the question, what is her motivation for coming back at the age of 44 when she's achieved pretty much everything there was to achieve in the sport? You know, she's won 23 Grand Slam titles. She's won 7 Wimbledons. She's won about 4 Olympic gold medals. She's just won absolutely everything. She was world number one for a number of weeks, 319 of them. So is it because she's sitting back and watching the tour now and thinking, I can still do that, and I want to add that elusive 24th Grand Slam title that would equal Margaret Court's record? Or is it that she wants to come back and maybe when her sister Venus potentially hangs up her racket at the US Open, did she want to kind of go out in a big hullabaloo at the US Open with her sister, which is kind of where everything started? But I just think these questions, we're going to find out more, I hope, over the coming weeks. But it is quite big news, but it is going to be exciting to see her back out on court.
What are the challenges of coming back, age 44, 4 years away, to succeed again and hit those heights that she did and clearly wants to do again?
Well, it's a massive challenge. I mean, we've been listening to Novak Djokovic over the last couple of seasons saying at 8, and he's 39 now, and he's just gone out at the Roland Garros to a young Brazilian player who was 19. And he's made no secret of the fact that his body at 39 has really struggled to keep up with the youngsters. He's done an unbelievable job of trying to, but he just has found it very, very difficult. We've seen, even with Emma Raducanu at age 23, when she's had all of her injury problems, she's had viral problems, she's just lost 3 back-to-back matches in a row with lack of confidence and lack of match play. And that's the key factor. It's one thing to be able to practice and hit the ball really well, but when you go out there into the arenas, it's a whole different thing, and your body feels different in competition with the adrenaline running through it, and it doesn't recover as well. So it is absolutely intriguing, but I don't doubt that when she gets on court, her aura, her reputation, what she brings to a tennis court will send a few quakes through the tour, and there'll be a lot of nerves down the other end of the court, that's for sure, because she has such an aura.
We look forward to it. Annabelle Croft, thank you very much indeed. Very interesting thoughts there. Significant event at Roland Garros, by the way. First women's singles match in the primetime evening slot for 3 years saw Aryna Sabalenka beating Naomi Osaka in straight sets, and she through to the quarterfinals. Coverage of the quarterfinals in the men's starts today. 5 Sports Extra, BBC Sounds from noon. And here's hoping the weather in Taunton holds for the deciding women's T20 between England and the 50-over world champions India. Commentary from 6:15.
Jonathan, thank you. This weekend, Radio 4 explores a young literary life.
Now, I will take confession. You first, Dylan Marlais Thomas.
The Welsh writer shares his young adventures.
You've got the best black eye in Wales, maybe all of Europe.
Young writings.
I was a published poet. The only thing wrong was that the poems weren't by me.
And young romances.
As she nodded, her curls swung, and I knew in that moment, this is love.
Geraint Howell stars in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog, by Dylan Thomas, this Sunday afternoon at 3. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. And at 26 minutes to 9, it's time for a summary of the news with Charles Carroll.
A report just published by the UN's climate and weather body, the World Meteorological Organization, is warning that one of the strongest El Niños on record may be developing in the Pacific Ocean. This is a natural weather phenomenon which results in hotter and drier weather than usual in some places and significantly wetter conditions in others. The WMO's Secretary General, Celeste Saulo, told us that everyone needed to pay attention to rising global temperatures, saying El Niño could make the situation more challenging. The Russian military says that it's carried out what it called a massive strike on Ukraine, targeting cities with drones and ballistic missiles. Ukrainian officials say at least 13 people have been killed and more than 100 injured. And police have released body cam footage of the moment officers handcuffed a student who had been fatally stabbed after his killer falsely claimed to have been racially abused by him. Henry Novak, who was 18, was attacked in Southampton last year. His family said his treatment by police was degrading.
It is 25 to 9, and let us stay with that news. So the father of Henry Novak says he's tormented by the ordeal that his son underwent. Mark Novak said the contrast between how his son and the killer had been treated by police was unbearable. Henry should not have died on the streets of Southampton in police custody, he said. He called it inhumane and degrading. Vikram Digwa, the murderer, sent to prison for life yesterday, and the police body cam footage released, which shows them handcuffing the innocent dying man.
What's happened to you, right? You've been stabbed. Whereabouts? I don't think you have, mate.
Let us talk to Nazir Afzal, who's a former Chief Crown Prosecutor for the North West of England, also Chief Executive of the UK's Police and Crime Commissioners. And David Spencer's also on the line, Head of Crime and Justice at the think tank Policy Exchange, a former Detective Chief Inspector himself at the Met. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Nazir Afzal, when we look at that, when you look at that, what do you think?
Well, it tells you that, firstly, the murder of Henry Novak is a human tragedy, but it does raise questions, very raise questions about police training, about judgment, about standards. We all know, and David knows this, police officers are often required to make decisions under pressure, and nobody expects perfection. But what we've got here is, it started, I would imagine, Justin, before the body cam. It started with a phone call, the 999 call made by the killer's brother, which suggested to the police or told the police that Henry was in some way a perpetrator. And the officers arrived with that mindset, and everything else snowballed from there. There was an apparent unwillingness on their part to accept his account, but clearly to accept the account of those who made the call. There was insufficient scrutiny. The footage gives the impression, really, that they treated him as the perpetrator rather than the victim. And it ultimately gives this impression that literally people will be treated very badly depending on what circumstances the police find them in.
And
standards did fall short.
Yeah. So if standards fell short, David Spencer, are we talking about simply incompetence or something else?
Well, clearly this is devastating to watch, and there does need to be full disclosure by the police here. We cannot have any secrecy or any delay whatsoever. But I think the important thing here is that it's not sufficient to look at this as just an isolated incident. And the wider policy question in particular, for me, is the fear of being called a racist now so embedded in the minds of frontline officers to such a degree that this seems to trump everything else? And when I speak to my former colleagues, to serving police officers today, that is absolutely uppermost on their mind. And so I don't think we can just look at this isolated incident, as important as it is and as much as it needs to be scrutinised. We need to look at the broader culture that has been created in policing. So what is the training the officers have received? What is the pressure that activist groups have built on the police? Who is advising the police in terms of the training they receive? I think there's a much broader question here to be asked.
Nazir Afzal, do you agree at least that question should be asked?
I mean, I don't disagree at all. I think that clearly what happened was the result of more than one individual's actions. It wasn't the officers on the scene alone. There are issues around training. There are certainly issues around the quality and competence of officers. I think the IOPC clearly will look at what happened on the night, and there's clearly a need, in my view, certainly a view around what we should look at, what we're expecting from officers when they come to situations like this. Here what we had was a catalogue of failures. All of them, unfortunately, could have been avoided. It's sad, very sad, that Henry has suffered the way he did.
But I suppose, can I put this to you, though, that the question is not necessarily what happened there. I mean, that's obviously a big part of it. But it's also what will have shaped the officers' minds before they arrived. And that at least, as David Spencer was suggesting, is a legitimate question now. The extent to which we have put in the minds of police officers, to put it bluntly, that white people are liable to be the perpetrators of crime and people with darker skins the victims.
As I said, I'm happy for that to be looked at. There have been significant increases in police officer numbers over the last few years. I don't know what they've been trained. David and I have not been involved in policing or justice for a while now. Yes, accountability, though, is not about just assigning blame. We want to ensure this doesn't happen again in the future. And I think, yes, let's look at all the questions around this. As I said a moment ago, I think it started that with a 909 call. We can't forget that those officers arrived thinking that Henry Novak was the perpetrator. Mm. And that clearly had a part to play in this. But, you know, as I said, the IOPC will play its part. And I've no doubt that David's right, that we need to look at the broader picture about how we train police officers.
Is the broader picture, David Spencer, does it go all the way back to Lord McPherson? Because you think back to the awful racist murder that led to the McPherson report and led to this idea of institutional racism. Do we need to revisit that now?
Yes, I think it does go back that far. And that's why it is so important that we do not just focus on the individual officers in this case. It goes back over a long period of time and it goes right to the top of policing and actually into government. And if I can just touch on the Independent Office for Police Conduct, I'm afraid I have very little confidence in their ability to get to the bottom of things at speed in this case, because they have shown in the past that that's not necessarily something they're very good at. And actually, they have been part of creating a culture, a broader culture, where there is the creation of, in the mindset of officers, the fear that racism trumps everything else. So I'm afraid I have little confidence in the IOPC to do what's necessary.
And when you say it goes into government, what do you mean by that?
Well, a few years ago, the police issued what's called the Police Race Action Plan. And that was in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder in the United States. And that is a policy document, essentially, which embeds this political idea of anti-racism into policing. Now, that is a policy which has been supported or certainly not opposed by previous governments and current governments. And so I think there is a question here is around the operational independence of policing and therefore what is a matter for policy, i.e. government, and what is a matter for operational police chiefs, i.e. individual operational decision making. And I think that is a broader question which also needs to be looked at here.
David Spencer and Nazir Afzal as well. Thank you both very much.
17 minutes to 9. Talks are continuing at a rapid pace with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So said President Trump 12 or so hours ago now. We know that the perception of how successful those negotiations are often varies depending on whether you're hearing it from Washington or Tehran. But one potential sticking point may have been resolved. Donald Trump said last night on Truth Social that after a call he'd had with highly placed representatives, in his words, from Hezbollah, that they would stop firing from Lebanon on Israel. He also insisted that Benjamin Netanyahu had agreed not to attack the Lebanese capital, Beirut. If further Israeli military escalation in Lebanon is halted like this, it does give discussions to pause the war in Iran a slightly greater chance of success. Well, Sassan Karimi is Assistant Professor of Global Studies at the University of Tehran. I put it to him that Hezbollah was acting more in the interests of Iran than of Lebanese citizens in the south.
I'm not sure about the Lebanese citizens, but they are also Lebanese citizens, the Hezbollah themselves. Definitely, resistance and military conflicts always raise differentiation between the different parts of the nation, but it doesn't mean that the whole nation of Lebanon or agree or disagree with the Hezbollah efforts. Anyways, at the moment, it can be a good step to stop attacking Lebanon, attacking Hezbollah by Israel. Israel want to spoil any potential resolution of the Iran-United States conflict. And that is why from every door it enters to destruct the path and the tracks between Iran and the United States. Attacking Lebanon, attacking the sovereignty of Lebanon country, and attacking the Hezbollah in the southern part of Lebanon is a part of spoiling a potential deal.
That's Sassan Karimi, Assistant Professor of Global Studies at the University of Tehran. I've also been speaking to Joel Rayburn, who wrote the Trump administration's strategy on Iran during its first term and is now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute.
President Trump's in a position where he is, for a variety of reasons, reluctant, I think, to return to outright use of military force. And he's giving as much space as possible to allow the diplomatic initiative to see if it can work. I think the reason for strategic patience on President Trump's part is that the U.S. side expects that in the event of a renewal of a large-scale confrontation, that the Iranian regime would lash out militarily at the Arab Gulf states, targeting their critical energy infrastructure, maybe some other critical infrastructures such as desalination plants, in a way that could risk a shock to the global economy. And I also think that the U.S. judges that it's not necessary at this point to return to that kind of military pressure while the U.S. naval blockade of the Iranian regime is working and is essentially disrupting the Iranian regime's revenue stream every day.
And we've heard from senior U.S. figures that a longer-term ceasefire is within reach, but an immediate problem has presented itself just now, and that is what Israel is doing in Lebanon, the expansion of Israeli military action in Lebanon, which has an impact on what Iran is prepared to agree to and will change President Trump's ability to negotiate with them. So what kind of conversations do you think will be happening between President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu at the moment?
Essentially, what is happening is the Iranian regime is trying to stretch its leverage in the Strait of Hormuz and other military pressure to extend to another country, Lebanon, and to use their leverage in the Strait of Hormuz to enable Hezbollah to survive its ongoing war with Israel.
What that doesn't take into account, though, is the benefit that Benjamin Netanyahu derives in an election year, months away from elections, we don't know the date just yet, but derives from a strong military campaign in Lebanon. I mean, there must be a reason why President Trump is involved here and is saying, we believe, to Benjamin Netanyahu, do not attack Beirut.
Well, I think that's a little bit too much criminology on Israeli decision-making. I mean, regardless whether it was Prime Minister Netanyahu or any other Israeli leader right now, there's no way that they could tolerate Hezbollah continuing to do the kind of attacks into northern Israel's population centers and against Israeli military outposts that they're doing right now, including some very advanced weaponry.
Why then is President Trump not being stronger on Lebanon? Of course, bearing in mind the separation between Hezbollah and the Lebanese state, why are we seeing President Trump saying to Israel, don't attack Beirut, let's have talks in Washington? I think what you're saying is somewhat cutting that out of the picture.
No, it's not. I mean, you're not seeing President Trump saying that, for example, the Israelis must meet Iran's demands, which is to cease all attacks against Hezbollah and withdraw physically from Lebanon. What the president is trying to do is to split the difference. He's trying to give the Israelis enough room where they can take military action to defend themselves, but without necessarily going all the way to the heart of the Hezbollah problem, which is in southern Beirut.
So what does, again, I keep coming back to President Trump because he is the ultimate decision maker in all of this. What does he need to do? Does he need to concede anywhere in the conversations that he's having with Iran? Where will his red lines be? How will he not, as you say, he doesn't necessarily want to go back to offensive military action in Iran. How does he make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, what he's got to have is a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz by the Iranians, and he's got to have a roadmap, a pathway to the dissolution of the Iranian nuclear program. If he can't secure those two strategic objectives, then he's going to have no choice but to take a very hard line, whether that's in even further economic crunch, I think supported by military pressure, let's say against Iran's revenue generating infrastructure, or whether it's an outright return to a military campaign against the regime itself, against its military assets, a regime leadership, and so on.
Joel Rayburn, thanks for speaking to us this morning.
And that brings us to 10 to 9. We heard from three young people earlier in the programme on their view of university. That came after the news today that a third of people in the British Attitudes Survey don't think now that it is worth going. Let us talk to Professor Robert Van Noort, who is the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Reading, and is not going to agree with that third, I take it, Professor.
Well, good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
If a third of people think that it may not be worth, then... that is just a reality, isn't it? I mean, life is difficult for young people. But if you look at the data, the evidence, it suggests that going to university in the long term is still a very good option. And it may not be the right option for everybody. So I accept that for some people may say, this is really not for me. But, for most of them it is. And evidence says that graduates are more likely to be in employment, more likely to be earning well, more likely to be healthier. And I think how universities are working, and I remember you were comparing the 2005 and the 2025 survey. Now, things have changed in universities. Nearly all my students are really focused on what they're going to do after graduation. They're taking the courses to get themselves in the best position to get a job. They are AI mindful. They really are really understanding how AI can help them in their future jobs, doing a better job and drive productivity. So we have changed how we teach. Students have changed how they work and what they aim for at university.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's such a fascinating point. I was talking to a group of employers the other day, and they were saying actually they regretted that we got rid of polytechnics. They were saying that it was much better when there was much more in the way of vocational options that were degree options, but they were vocational in places that specialised in vocational training. And we've gone too much down the academic route for too many students who it just doesn't suit them.
Well, what the university does is just more than training people up for a job. However, when you talk about technical and vocational jobs, nurses are trained by universities, lab technicians are trained by universities. There are a lot of vocational and technical jobs that are at university. But I think Jack was, you were talking to this morning, isn't he? He went to university to do physiotherapy. Mm. And he was talking about kind of going to university is more than just learning a job. He's networking with new people, learning lots of new skills, finding himself on the way and growing up as a human being.
It's a pricey way to do it, isn't it?
Well, I accept that. But I think education is for life, not just for the first few years after graduation. And it's not necessarily for everybody, or not everybody is ready to go to university, like Kathleen you were talking to this morning, maybe later in life. But it is an investment in your whole life, and there are benefits financially and beyond finances that are worth keeping a mind on.
Yeah, and I suppose that is the point, isn't it? Particularly if you can go to a university where you are meeting people you wouldn't otherwise meet, that there is a solid thing that you're doing for yourself that you wouldn't otherwise have managed to do, particularly if the otherwise would have been staying at home.
Yes, and just to know, the University of Reading just celebrates its 100th anniversary, and we had lots of reunions coming back on campus. I've spoken to people who studied here 50 years or more ago, and some of them are still in touch with their friends. When part of the entertainment, we had the Morris dancing group who got to know each other for occupying the vice chancellor's office in 1970s to oppose a rent increase. They have been making friends for life, and they come back now on a regular basis. And, it has changed their lives, even though they all went their own way and built their own careers.
Yeah, the joys of university sit-ins. There was something about those innocent days, wasn't there? Professor Robert Van Den Noort, thank you very much.
6 minutes to 9 now. In her day, Eleanor Glanville was dismissed as eccentric, but she was in fact a pioneering naturalist, and her studies of butterflies turned up rare species that most people never actually got to see. Her choice of hobby saw her persecuted, though, and accused of madness. And her story is now told in a new play called Butterfly, which has been written by Claire Jackson, who joins us, as does Leah Korsgaard, who is author of The Butterfly Season, which documents her quest to see all of Denmark's native butterfly species in one single summer. Good morning, both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Claire, she did really, you know, interesting and important work. But as we said, back at that time, it was used as a reason, an excuse to bring her down.
Yes, I think the thing with butterflying is it does involve some rather eccentric activities. I mean, you are kind of traipsing through meadows and woods, often on your own, and it can be perceived as being quite unusual.
Leah, do you consider yourself to be unusual? I mean, I love watching butterflies, so I'm on your side here. But do you feel that way ever?
Yeah, no, I can completely relate to that. When I first got the idea that I wanted to see all the butterfly species in Denmark in a single year, I knew nothing about butterflies, not at all. I didn't speak the language of nature, so to me, it was mad in a sense. Crazy, like, why spend time on such a thing, right? But I just felt this lurking passion. There was something that wanted to be let out. Mad, in a sense.
What, for you, Leah, was it about the butterflies or was it about the thrill of the quest?
Well, I think it was about both. What started as just a simple exercise in discovery really became a reckoning with all the big questions of why are we here? What is our relationship to nature? Why do we long for transformation? All those major questions that you someday will ask yourself when you're out in the meadow or in a deep, deep forest. And I think the pull, the longing was to, of course, see the butterflies, but also to confront myself with these important questions.
Yeah. Why was it, Claire, back in those days that the people didn't see it for Eleanor Glanville the way that Leah describes it there?
Well, I think she was just perceived as being a bit of a mad woman, really. She was very keen on collecting, which as it still is seen as quite a male pursuit, actually. But of course, it's not. It's for everyone.
What did she leave us with in her work? In fact, she's got a butterfly named after her still, hasn't she?
She does, and I think that's how I came to her, really, because like Leah, I've been doing the British equivalent and following all the British species, and they all have very evocative names, like we have the wood white, and the speckled wood, and meadow brown. And then we have this fritillary that's called the Glanville fritillary. And this is the only butterfly, British butterfly, that we have that's actually named after the person who discovered it. And that person was Eleanor.
Yeah.
I found that incredibly compelling that she was a woman and she was working in the 18th century and that is her legacy.
And managed to achieve that. I feel that you, Leah, deserve your own butterfly in your honour as well. I wonder as well, you know, we talk about the big questions of life that you explored through this. Do you get the feeling that if a man were to do something similar, he would be lauded for his scientific prowess rather than perhaps considered to be a little bit eccentric?
No, I think there's something to that, right? The great author, one of my favorite authors, Vladimir Nabokov, he was also a renowned butterfly expert, and he called his passion his demon, right? There was something really mad about his longing to see these species, but that was not considered weird or mad or eccentric. That was just him being an expert. But I do think that in the history of the butterfly experts, there's definitely it's more weird when a woman has this kind of passion, or maybe actually dangerous, I would say.
And just very quickly, Lee, you're waiting. You haven't completed all of it, but you're waiting. You're not desperately seeking out the last couple that aren't on your list that you haven't seen yet.
Well, I tried to see every one of them in 1 year. But in the end, in the fall, there was one missing on my list, the Mellow Skipper. And I was